She pushed back thoughts of him as Sebastian's fingers traced her cheeks and the line of her jaw. His touch was gentle, despite the calluses on his fingertips. Of course, Jace had the same calluses from fighting. Probably all Shadowhunters had them. She clamped down on the thought of Jace, or tried to, but it was no good. She could see him even with her eyes closed. See the sharp angles and planes of a face she could never properly draw, no matter how much the image of it had burned itself into her mind. See the delicate bones of his hands, the scarred skin of his shoulders. The fierce longing that had surged up in her so swiftly receded with a sharp recoil that was like an elastic band springing back. She went numb. Even as Sebastian's lips pressed down on hers and his hands moved to cup the back of her neck, she went numb with an icy shock of wrongness. Something was terribly wrong. Something even more than her hopeless longing for someone she could never have. This was something else. A sudden jolt of horror, as if she'd been taking a confident step forward and suddenly plunged into a black void. She gasped and jerked away from Sebastian with such force that she almost stumbled. If he hadn't been holding her, she would have fallen. Clary. His eyes were unfocused, his cheeks flushed with a high bright color. Clary, what's wrong?
Nothing.
Her voice sounded thin to her own ears. Nothing, it's just, I shouldn't have, I'm not really ready. Did we go too fast? We can take it slower. He reached for her. And before she could stop herself, she flinched away. He looked stricken. I'm not going to hurt you, Clary.
I know.
Did something happen? His hand came up, stroked her hair back. She bit back the urge to jerk away. Did Jace...
Jace? Did he know she'd been thinking about Jace? Had he been able to tell?
And at the same time, Jace is my brother. Why would you bring him up like that? What do you mean?
I just thought... He shook his head, pain and confusion chasing each other across his features. That maybe somebody else had hurt you.
His hand was still on her cheek. She reached up and gently but firmly detached it, returning it to his side.
No, nothing like that. I just... She hesitated. It felt wrong.
Wrong? The hurt on his face vanished, replaced by disbelief. Clary... We have a connection. You know we do. Since the first second I saw you.
Sebastian, don't.
I felt like you were someone I'd always been waiting for. I saw you feel it, too. Don't tell me you didn't.
But that hadn't been what she'd felt.
She'd felt as if she'd walked around a corner in a strange city and suddenly seen her own brownstone looming up in front of her. A surprising and not entirely pleasant recognition, almost. How can this be here?
I didn't, she said.
The anger that rose in his eyes, sudden, dark, uncontrolled, took her by surprise. He caught her wrists in a painful grasp. That's not true. She tried to pull away.
Sebastian!
It's not true. The blackness of his eyes seemed to have swallowed up the pupils. His face was like a white mask, stiff and rigid.
Sebastian! She said as calmly as she could.
You're hurting me. He let go of her. His chest was rising and falling rapidly. I'm sorry, he said. I'm sorry. I thought...
Well, you thought wrong, Clary wanted to say, but she bit the words back.
She didn't want to see that look on his face again.
We should go back, she said instead. It'll be dark soon.
He nodded numbly, seeming as shocked by his outburst as she was. He turned and headed back toward Wayfarer, who was cropping grass in the long shadow of a tree. Clary hesitated a moment, then followed him. There didn't seem to be anything else she could do. She glanced down surreptitiously at her wrists as she fell into step behind him. They were ringed with red where his fingers had gripped her, and more strangely, her fingertips were smudged black, as if she had somehow stained them with ink. Sebastian was silent as he helped her up onto Wayfarer's back.
I'm sorry if I implied anything about Jace, he said finally as she settled herself in the saddle. He would never do anything to hurt you. I know it's for your sake that he's been visiting that vampire prisoner in the guard.
It was as if everything in the world ground to a sudden halt. Clary could hear her own breath whistling in and out of her ears, saw her hands, frozen like the hands of a statue, lying still against the saddle pommel.
"Vampire prisoner?" she whispered.
Sebastian turned a surprised face up to hers.
"Yes," he said. "Simon, that vampire they brought over with them from New York, I was sure you knew all about it.
Didn't Jace tell you?"
Chapter 8. One of the Living. Simon woke to sunlight glinting brightly off an object that had been shoved through the bars of his window. He got to his feet, his body aching with hunger, and saw that it was a metal flask about the size of a lunchbox thermos. A rolled-up bit of notepaper had been tied around the neck. Plucking it down, Simon unrolled the paper and read. "Simon, this is cow blood, fresh from the butcher's. Hope it's all right. Jace told me what you said, and I want you to know I think it's really brave. Just hang in there and we'll figure out a way to get you out. Isabel." Simon smiled at the scribbled X's and O's that ran along the bottom of the page. Good to know Isabel's flamboyant affection hadn't suffered under the current circumstances. He unscrewed the flask's top and had swallowed several mouthfuls before a sharp, prickling sensation between his shoulder blades made him turn around. Raphael stood calmly in the center of the room. He had his hands clasped behind his back, his slight shoulders set. He was wearing a sharply pressed white shirt and a dark jacket. A gold chain glittered at his throat. Simon almost gagged on the blood he was drinking. He swallowed hard, still staring.
You can't be here."
Raphael's smile somehow managed to give the impression that his fangs were showing, even though they weren't.
"Don't panic, Daylighter."
"I'm not panicking."
This wasn't strictly true. Simon felt as if he'd swallowed something sharp. He hadn't seen Raphael since the night he'd clawed himself bloody and bruised out of a hastily dug grave in Queens. He still remembered Raphael throwing packets of animal blood at him and the way he'd torn into them with his teeth as if he were an animal himself. It wasn't something he liked to remember. He would have been happy never to see the vampire boy again.
"The sun's still up. How are you here?"
"I'm not." Raphael's voice was smooth as butter. "I am a projection. Look."
He swung his hand, passing it through the stone wall beside him.
"I am like smoke. I cannot hurt you. Of course, neither can you hurt me."
"I don't want to hurt you." Simon set the flask down on the cot. "I do want to know what you're doing here."
"You left New York very suddenly, Daylighter. You do realize that you're supposed to inform the head vampire of your local area when you're leaving the city, don't you?"
"Head vampire? You mean you... I thought the head vampire was someone else."
"Camille has not yet returned to us," Raphael said, without any apparent emotion. "I lead in her stead." "You'd know all this if you'd bothered to get acquainted with the laws of your kind."
"My leaving New York wasn't exactly planned in advance. And no offense, but I don't really think of you as my kind."
"Dios." Raphael lowered his eyes as if hiding amusement. "You are stubborn."
"How can you say that?"
"It seems obvious, doesn't it?"
"I mean..."
Simon's throat closed up.
"That word. You can say it, and I can't say...
God."
Raphael's eyes flashed upward. He did look amused.
"Age," he said. "And practice. And faith. Or its loss. They are in some ways the same thing. You will learn over time, little fledgling."
"Don't call me that."
"But it is what you are. You're a child of the night. Isn't that why Valentine captured you and took your blood? Because of what you are?"
"You seem pretty well informed," Simon said. "Maybe you should tell me."
Raphael's eyes narrowed.
"I have also heard a rumor that you drank the blood of a shadow hunter, and that is what gave you your gift, your ability to walk in sunlight. Is it true?"
Simon's hair prickled.
"That's ridiculous. If shadow hunter blood could give vampires the ability to walk in daylight, everyone would know about it by now. Nephilim blood would be at a premium, and there would never be peace between vampires and shadow hunters after that. So it's a good thing it isn't true."
A faint smile turned up the edges of Raphael's mouth.
"True enough." Speaking of premiums, you do realize, don't you, Daylighter, that you are a valuable commodity now? There isn't a downworlder on this earth who doesn't want to get their hands on you. Does that include you? Of course it does. And what would you do if you did get your hands on me?
Raphael shrugged his slight shoulders. Perhaps I am alone in thinking that the ability to walk in the daylight might not be such a gift as other vampires believe. We are the children of the night for a reason. It is possible that I consider you as much of an abomination as humanity considers me.
Do you?
It's possible.
Raphael's expression was neutral.
I think you're a danger to us all. A danger to vampire kind, if you will. And you can't stay in this cell forever, Daylighter. Eventually you'll have to leave and face the world again. Face me again. But I can tell you one thing. I will swear to do no harm and not try to find you, if you in turn swear to hide yourself away once Aldertree releases you. If you swear to go so far away that no one will ever find you, and to never again contact anyone you knew in your mortal life, I can't be more fair than that. But Simon was already shaking his head.
I can't leave my family. Or Clary.
Raphael made an irritable noise.
They are no longer part of who you are. You're a vampire now.
But I don't want to be, said Simon.
Look at you complaining, said Raphael. You will never get sick, never die, and be strong and young forever. You will never age. What have you got to complain about?
Young forever, Simon thought. It sounded good. But did anyone really want to be 16 forever? It would have been one thing to be frozen forever at 25, but 16? To always be this gangly? To never really grow into himself, his face, or his body? Not to mention that, looking like this, he'd never be able to go into a bar and order a drink, ever, for eternity.
And, Raphael added, you do not even have to give up the sun.
Simon had no desire to go down that road again. I heard the others talking about you and Dumour, he said. I know you put on a cross every Sunday and go to see your family. I bet they don't even know you're a vampire. So don't tell me to leave everyone in my life behind. I won't do it, and I won't lie and say I will.
Raphael's eyes glittered. What my family believes doesn't matter. It's what I believe, what I know. A true vampire knows he is dead. He accepts his death, but you think you are still one of the living. It is that which makes you so dangerous. You cannot acknowledge that you are no longer alive.
It was twilight when Clary shut the door of Amatus's house behind her and threw the bolts home. She leaned against the door for a long moment in the shadowy entryway, her eyes half shut. Exhaustion weighed down every one of her limbs, and her legs ached painfully. Clary? Amatus's insistent voice cut through the silence. Is that you? Clary stayed where she was, adrift in the calming darkness behind her closed eyes. She wanted so badly to be home, she could almost taste the metallic air of the Brooklyn streets. She could see her mother sitting in her chair by the window, dusty, pale yellow light streaming in through the open apartment windows, illuminating her canvas as she painted. Homesickness twisted in her gut like pain. Clary! The voice came from much closer this time. Clary's eyes snapped open. Amatus was standing in front of her, her gray hair pulled severely back, her hands on her hips. Your brother's here to see you. He's waiting in the kitchen.
Jace is here?
Clary fought to keep her rage and astonishment off her face. There was no point showing how angry she was in front of Luke's sister. Amatus was looking at her curiously.
Should I not have let him in? I thought you'd want to see him.
No, it's fine, Clary said, maintaining her even tone with some difficulty. I'm just tired.
Huh. Amatus looked as if she didn't believe it.
Well, I'll be upstairs if you want me. I need a nap. Clary couldn't imagine what she'd want Amatus for, but she nodded and limped down the corridor into the kitchen, which was awash with bright light. There was a bowl of fruit on the table, oranges, apples, and pears, and a loaf of thick bread along with butter and cheese, and a plate beside it of what looked like cookies? Had Amatus actually made cookies? At the table sat Jace. He was leaning forward on his elbows, his golden hair tousled,
his shirt slightly open at the neck. She could see the thick banding of black marks tracing his collarbone. He held a cookie in his bandaged hand. So Sebastian was right. He had hurt himself, not that she cared.
"Good," he said. "You're back. I was beginning to think you'd fallen into a canal."
Clary just stared at him, wordless. She wondered if he could read the anger in her eyes. He leaned back in the chair, throwing one arm casually over the back of it. If it hadn't been for the rapid pulse at the base of his throat, she might almost have believed his air of unconcern.
"You look exhausted," he added. "Where have you been all day?"
"I was out with Sebastian."
"Sebastian?"
His look of utter astonishment was momentarily gratifying. "He walked me home last night," Clary said. And in her mind, the words, "I'll just be your brother from now on, just your brother," beat like the rhythm of a damaged heart. "And so far, he's the only person in this city who's been remotely nice to me. So yes, I was out with Sebastian."
"I see."
Jace set his cookie back down on the plate, his face blank.
"Clary, I came here to apologize. I shouldn't have spoken to you the way I did."
"No," Clary said, "you shouldn't have.
I also came to ask you if you'd reconsider going back to New York."
"God," Clary said. "This again?"
"It's not safe for you here."
"What are you worried about?" she asked tonelessly. "That they'll throw me in prison like they did with Simon?"
Jace's expression didn't change, but he rocked back in his chair, the front legs lifting off the floor, almost as if she had shoved him.
"Simon?" "Sebastian told me what happened to him," she went on in the same flat voice. "What you did, how you brought him here and then let him just get thrown in jail. Are you trying to get me to hate you?"
"And you trust Sebastian?" Jace asked.
"You barely know him, Clary." She stared at him. "Is it not true?" He met her gaze, but his face had gone still, like Sebastian's face when she pushed him away.
"It's true."
She seized a plate off the table and flung it at him. He ducked, sending the chair spinning, and the plate hit the wall above the sink and shattered in a starburst of broken porcelain. He leaped out of the chair as she picked up another plate and threw it, her aim going wild. This one bounced off the refrigerator and hit the floor at Jace's feet, where it cracked into two even pieces. "How could you? Simon trusted you. Where is he now? What are they going to do to him?"
"Nothing," Jace said.
"He's all right. I saw him last night." "Before or after I saw you? Before or after you pretended everything was all right and you were just fine?"
"You came away from that thinking I was just fine?"
Jace choked on something, almost like a laugh.
"I must be a better actor than I thought."
There was a twisted smile on his face. It was a match to the tinder of Clary's rage. How dare he laugh at her now? She scrabbled for the fruit bowl, but it suddenly didn't seem like enough. She kicked the chair out of the way and flung herself at him, knowing it would be the last thing he'd expect her to do. The force of her sudden assault caught him off guard. She slammed into him and he staggered backward, fetching up hard against the edge of the counter. She half fell against him, heard him gasp, and drew back her arm blindly, not even knowing what she intended to do. She had forgotten how fast he was. Her fist slammed, not into his face, but into his upraised hand. He wrapped his fingers around hers, forcing her arm back down to her side. She was suddenly aware of how close they were standing. She was leaning against him, pressing him back against the counter with the slight weight of her body. "Let go of my hand."
"Are you really going to hit me if I do?"
His voice was rough and soft, his eyes blazing.
"Don't you think you deserve it?"
She felt the rise and fall of his chest against her as he laughed without amusement.
"Do you think I planned all this? Do you really think I'd do that?"
"Well, you don't like Simon, do you? Maybe you never have." Jace made a harsh, incredulous sound and let go of her hand. When Clary stepped back, he held out his right arm, palm up. It took her a moment to realize what he was showing her, the ragged scar along his wrist. "This," he said, his voice as taut as a wire, "is where I cut my wrist to let your vampire friend drink my blood. It nearly killed me. And now you think what, that I just abandoned him without a thought?" She stared at the scar on Jace's wrist, one of so many all over his body, scars of all shapes and sizes. "Sebastian told me that you brought Simon here, and then Alec marched him up to the guard. Let the Clave have him. You must have known.
I brought him here by accident. I asked him to come to the Institute so I could talk to him. About you, actually. I thought maybe he could convince you to drop the idea of coming to Idris. If it's any consolation, he wouldn't even consider it. While he was there, we were attacked by Forsaken. I had to drag him through the portal with me. It was that or leave him there to die.
But why bring him to the Clave? You must have known.
The reason we sent him there was because the only portal in Idris is in the guard. They told us they were sending him back to New York.
And you believed them? After what happened with the Inquisitor?
Clary, the Inquisitor was an anomaly. That might have been your first experience with the Clave, but it wasn't mine. The Clave is us, the Nephilim. They abide by the law.
Except they didn't.
No, Jay said. They didn't. He sounded very tired. And the worst part about all this, he added, is remembering Valentine ranting about the Clave, how it's corrupt, how it needs to be cleansed. And by the angel, if I don't agree with him.
Clary was silent. First because she could think of nothing to say. And then, in startlement, as Jace reached out, almost as if he weren't thinking about what he was doing, and drew her toward him. To her surprise, she let him. Through the white material of his shirt, she could see the outlines of his marks, black and curling, stroking across his skin like licks of flame. She wanted to lean her head against him, wanted to feel his arms around her, the way she'd wanted air when she was drowning in Lake Lynn. He might be right that things need fixing, she said finally, but he's not right about the way they should be fixed. You can see that, can't you? He half closed his eyes. There were crescents of gray shadow under them, she saw, the remnants of sleepless nights.
I'm not sure I can see anything. You're right to be angry, Clary. I shouldn't have trusted the Clave. I wanted so badly to think that the Inquisitor was an abnormality, that she was acting without their authority, that there was still some part of being a shadow hunter I could trust.
Jace, she whispered.
He opened his eyes and looked down at her. She and Jace were standing close enough, she realized, that they were touching all up and down their bodies. Even their knees were touching, and she could feel his heartbeat.
Move away from him, she told herself. But her legs wouldn't obey.
What is it? He said, his voice very soft.
I want to see Simon, she said. Can you take me to see him?
As abruptly as he had caught hold of her, he let her go. No. You're not even supposed to be in Idris. You can't go waltzing into the guard.
But he'll think everyone's abandoned him. He'll think...
I went to see him, Jay said. I was going to let him out. I was going to tear the bars out of the window with my hands. His voice was matter of fact, but he wouldn't let me.
He wouldn't let you? He wanted to stay in jail?
He said the Inquisitor was sniffing around after my family, after me. Aldertree wants to blame what happened in New York on us. He can't grab one of us and torture it out of us. The Clave would frown on that. But he's trying to get Simon to tell him some story where we're all in cahoots with Valentine. Simon said if I break him out, then the Inquisitor will know I did it, and it'll be even worse for the Lightwoods.
That's very noble of him and all, but what's his long-range plan, to stay in jail forever?
Jay shrugged. We hadn't exactly worked that out.
Clary blew out an exasperated breath. Boys, she said. All right, look, what you need is an alibi. We'll make sure you're somewhere everyone can see you, and the Lightwoods are too, and then we'll get Magnus to break Simon out of prison and get him back to New York.
I hate to tell you this, Clary, but there's no way Magnus would do that. I don't care how cute he thinks Alec is. He's not going to go directly against the Clave as a favor to us.
He might, Clary said, for the Book of the White.
Jace blinked. The what?
Quickly, Clary told him about Ragnar Fell's death, about Magnus showing up in Fell's place, and about the spellbook. Jace listened with stunned attentiveness until she finished.
Demons? He said. Magnus said Fell was killed by demons?
Clary cast her mind back. No, he said the place stank of something demonic in origin, and that Fell was killed by Valentine's servants. That's all he said.
Some dark magic leaves an aura that reeks like demons, Jace said. If Magnus wasn't specific,
It's probably because he's none too pleased that there's a warlock out there practicing dark magic, breaking the law. But it's hardly the first time Valentine's gotten one of Lilith's children to do his nasty bidding. Remember the warlock kid he killed in New York?
Valentine used his blood for the ritual, I remember. Clary shuddered. Jace, does Valentine want the book for the same reason I do? To wake my mother up?
He might. Or if it's what Magnus says it is, Valentine might just want it for the power he could gain from it. Either way, we'd better get it before he does.
Do you think there's any chance it's in the Wayland Manor?
I know it's there, he said to her surprise. That cookbook? Recipes for housewives or whatever? I've seen it before. In the manor's library. It was the only cookbook in there.
Clary felt dizzy. She almost hadn't let herself believe it could be true. Jace, if you take me to the manor and we get the book, I'll go home with Simon. Do this for me and I'll go to New York and I won't come back, I swear.
Magnus was right. There are misdirection wards on the manor, he said slowly. I'll take you there, but it's not close. Walking, it might take us 5 hours.
Clary reached out and drew his stele out of its loop on his belt. She held it up between them, where it glowed with a faint white light, not unlike the light of the glass towers. Who said anything about walking?
You get some strange visitors, Daylighter, Samuel said. First, Jonathan Morgenstern, and now the head vampire of New York City. I'm impressed.
Jonathan Morgenstern? It took Simon a moment to realize that this was, of course, Jace.
He was sitting on the floor in the center of the room, turning the empty flask in his hands over and over idly. I guess I'm more important than I realized.
And Isabel Lightwood bringing you blood, Simon said. That's quite a delivery service.
Simon's head went up. How do you know Isabel brought it? I didn't say anything.
I saw her through the window. She looks just like her mother, said Samuel. At least, the way her mother did years ago.
There was an awkward pause.
You know, the blood is only a stopgap, he added. Pretty soon the Inquisitor will start wondering if you've starved to death yet. If he finds you perfectly healthy, he'll figure out something's up and kill you anyway.
Simon looked up at the ceiling. The runes carved into the stone overlapped one another like shingled sand on a beach.
I guess I'll just have to believe Jace when he says they'll find a way to get me out, he said.
When Samuel said nothing in return, he added,
I'll ask him to get you out too, I promise. I won't leave you down here.
Samuel made a choked noise like a laugh that couldn't quite make it out of his throat.
Oh, I don't think Jace Morgenstern is going to want to rescue me, he said. Besides, starving down here is the least of your problems, Daylighter. Soon enough, Valentine will attack the city, and then we'll likely all be killed.
Simon blinked.
How can you be so sure? I was close to him at one point. I knew his plans, his goals. He intends to destroy Alicante's ward and strike at the clay from the heart of their power.
But I thought no demons could get past the wards. I thought they were impenetrable.
So it's said. It requires demon blood to take the wards down, you see. And it can only be done from inside Alicante. But because no demon can get through the wards, well, it's a perfect paradox, or should be. But Valentine claimed he'd found a way to get around that, a way to break through, and I believe him. He will find a way to take the wards down, and he will come into the city with his demon army, and he will kill us all.
The flat certainty in Samuel's voice sent a chill up Simon's spine.
You sound awfully resigned. Shouldn't you do something? Warn the Clave? I did warn them, when they interrogated me. I told them over and over again that Valentine meant to destroy the wards, but they dismissed me. The Clave thinks the wards will stand forever because they've stood for 1,000 years. But so did Rome till the barbarians came. Everything falls someday.
He chuckled, a bitter, angry sound.
Consider it a race to see who kills you first, Daylighter. Valentine, the other downworlders, or the Clave.
Somewhere between here and there, Clary's hand was torn out of Jace's. When the hurricane spit her out and she hit the floor, she hit it alone, hard, and rolled gasping to a stop. She sat up slowly and looked around. She was lying in the center of a Persian rug thrown over the floor of a large stone-walled room. There were items of furniture here and there. The white sheets thrown over them turned them into humped, unwieldy ghosts. Velvet curtains sagged across huge glass windows. The velvet was gray-white with dust, and motes of dust danced in the moonlight. Clary? Jace emerged from behind a massive, white-sheeted shape. It might have been a grand piano. Are you all right? Fine. She stood up, wincing a little. Her elbow ached. Aside from the fact that Amatis will probably kill me when we get back, considering that I smashed all her plates and opened a portal in her kitchen. He reached his hand down to her. For whatever it's worth, he said, helping her to her feet, I was very impressed. Thanks. Clary glanced around. So this is where you grew up? It's like something out of a fairy tale.
I was thinking a horror movie, Jay said. God, it's been years since I've seen this place. It didn't used to be so cold?
Clary shivered a little.
She buttoned her coat, but the cold in the manor was more than physical cold.
The place felt cold, as if there had never been warmth or light or laughter inside it.
No, said Jace. It was always cold. I was going to say dusty.
He took a witchlight stone out of his pocket, and it flared to life between his fingers. Its white glow lit his face from beneath, picking out the shadows under his cheekbones, the hollows at his temples.
This is the study, and we need the library. Come on.
He led her from the room and down a long corridor lined with dozens of mirrors that gave back their own reflections. Clary hadn't realized quite how disheveled she looked. Her coat streaked with dust, her hair snarled from the wind. She tried to smooth it down discreetly and caught Jace's grin in the next mirror. For some reason, due doubtless to a mysterious shadow hunter magic she didn't have a hope of understanding, his hair looked perfect. The corridor was lined with doors. Some open. Through them, Clary could glimpse other rooms, as dusty and unused-looking as the study had been. Michael Wayland had had no relatives, Valentine had said, so she supposed no one had inherited this place after his death. She had assumed Valentine had carried on living here, but that seemed clearly not to be the case. Everything breathed sorrow and disuse. At Renwick's, Valentine had called this place home, had showed it to Jace in the portal mirror. A gilt-edged memory of green fields and mellow stone. But that, Clary thought, had been a lie, too. It was clear Valentine hadn't really lived here in years. Perhaps he had just left it here to rot, or he had come here only occasionally to walk the dim corridors like a ghost. They reached a door at the end of the hallway, and Jace shouldered it open, standing back to let Clary pass into the room before him. She had been picturing the library at the Institute, and this room was not entirely unlike it. The same walls filled with row upon row of books, the same ladders on rolling casters so the high shelves could be reached. The ceiling was flat and beamed, though not conical, and there was no desk. Green velvet curtains, their folds iced with white dust, hung over windows that alternated panes of green and blue glass. In the moonlight, they sparkled like colored frost. Beyond the glass, all was black. This is the library? She said to Jace in a whisper, though she wasn't sure why she was whispering. There was something so profoundly still about the big, empty house. He was looking past her, his eyes dark with memory.
I used to sit in that window seat and read whatever my father had assigned me that day. Different languages on different days. French on Saturday, English on Sunday. But I can't remember now what day Latin was, if it was Monday or Tuesday.
Clary had a sudden flashing image of Jace as a little boy, book balanced on his knees as he sat in the window embrasure, looking out over what? Were there gardens? A view? A high wall of thorns like the wall around Sleeping Beauty's castle? She saw him as he read, the light that came in through the window casting squares of blue and green over his fair hair and the small face more serious than any 10-year-old should be.
I can't remember, he said again, staring into the dark.
She touched his shoulder. It doesn't matter, Jace.
I suppose not.
He shook himself as if waking out of a dream and moved across the room, the witchlight lighting his way. He knelt down to inspect a row of books and straightened up with one of them in his hand.
"Simple recipes for housewives," he said. "Here it is."
She hurried across the room and took it from him. It was a plain-looking book with a blue binding and dusty, like everything in the house. When she opened it, dust swarmed up from its pages like a gathering of moths. A large square hole had been cut out of the center of the book. Fitted into the hole like a jewel in a bezel was a smaller volume, about the size of a small chapbook bound in white leather with the title printed in gilded Latin letters. Clary recognized the words for white and book. But when she lifted it out and opened it, to her surprise, the pages were covered with thin, spidery handwriting in a language she couldn't understand.
"Greek," Jay said, looking over her shoulder, "of the ancient variety."
"Can you read it?"
"Not easily," he admitted. "It's been years. But Magnus will be able to, I imagine."
He closed the book and slipped it into the pocket of her green coat before turning back to the bookshelves, skimming his fingers along the rows of books, his fingertips tracing their spines. "Are there any of these you want to take with you?" she asked gently. "If you'd like."
Jace laughed and dropped his hand. "I was only allowed to read what I was assigned," he said. "Some of the shelves had books on them I wasn't even allowed to touch." He indicated a row of books higher up, bound in matching brown leather. "I read one of them once when I was about 6, just to see what the fuss was about. It turned out to be a journal my father was keeping. About me. Notes about my son Jonathan Christopher. He whipped me with a belt when he found out I'd read it. Actually, it was the first time I even knew I had a middle name." A sudden ache of hatred for her father went through Clary. "Well, Valentine's not here now."
"Clary," Jace began, a warning note in his voice, but she'd already reached up and yanked one of the books out from the forbidden shelf, knocking it to the ground. It made a satisfying thump.
"Clary."
"Oh, come on." She did it again, knocking another book down, and then another. Dust puffed up from their pages as they hit the floor.
"You try."
Jace looked at her for a moment, and then a half-smile teased the corner of his mouth. Reaching up, he swept his arm along the shelf, knocking the rest of the books to the ground with a loud crash. He laughed, and then broke off, lifting his head like a cat pricking up its ears at a distant sound.
"Do you hear that?"
"Hear what?" Clary was about to ask, and stopped herself. There was a sound, getting louder now, a high-pitched whirring and grinding, like the sound of machinery coming to life. The sound seemed to be coming from inside the wall. She took an involuntary step back just as the stones in front of them slid back with a groaning, rusty scream. An opening gaped behind the stones, a sort of doorway, roughly hacked out of the wall. Beyond the doorway was a set of stairs leading down into darkness. Chapter 9. This Guilty Blood.
"I didn't remember there even being a cellar here," Jay said, staring past Clary at the gaping hole in the wall.
He raised the witchlight, and its glow bounced off the downward-leading tunnel. The walls were black and slick, made of a smooth, dark stone Clary didn't recognize. The steps gleamed as if they were damp. A strange smell drifted up through the opening, dank, musty, with a weird metallic tinge that set her nerves on edge.
"What do you think could be down there?"
"I don't know."
Jace moved toward the stairs. He put a foot on the top step, testing it, and then shrugged as if he'd made up his mind. He began to make his way down the steps, moving carefully. Partway down, he turned and looked up at Clary.
"Are you coming? You can wait up here for me if you want to."
She glanced around the empty library, then shivered and hurried after him. The stairs spiraled down in tighter and tighter circles, as if they were making their way through the inside of a huge conch shell. The smell grew stronger as they reached the bottom, and the steps widened out into a large square room whose stone walls were streaked with the marks of damp and other, darker stains. The floor was scrawled with markings, a jumble of pentagrams and runes with white stones scattered here and there. Jace took a step forward and something crunched under his feet. He and Clary looked down at the same time.
"Bones," Clary whispered. "Not white stones after all, but bones of all shapes and sizes scattered across the floor." What was he doing here?
The witchlight burned in Jace's hand, casting its eerie glow over the room.
Experiments, Jace said in a dry, tense tone. The Seely Queen said,
What kind of bones are these? Clary's voice rose. Are they animal bones?
No.
Jace kicked a pile of bones with his feet, scattering them.
Not all of them.
Clary's chest felt tight.
I think we should go back.
Instead, Jace raised the witchlight in his hand. It blazed out brightly, and then more brightly, lighting the air with a harsh white brilliance. The far corners of the room sprang into focus. Three of them were empty. The fourth was blocked with a hanging cloth. There was something behind the cloth, a humped shape.
Jace, Clary whispered, what is that?
He didn't reply. There was a seraph blade in his free hand suddenly. Clary didn't know when he'd drawn it, but it shone in the witchlight like a blade of ice.
Jace, don't, said Clary,
but it was too late. He strode forward and twitched the cloth aside with the tip of the blade, then seized it and jerked it down. It fell in a blossoming cloud of dust. Jace staggered back, the witchlight falling from his grasp. As the blazing light fell, Clary caught a single glimpse of his face. It was a white mask of horror. Clary snatched the witchlight up before it could go dark and raised it high, desperate to see what could have shocked Jace. Unshockable Jace, so badly. At first, all she saw was the shape of a man. A man wrapped in a dirty white rag crouched on the floor. Manacles circled his wrists and ankles, attached to thick metal staples driven into the stone floor.
How can he be alive? Clary thought in horror, and bile rose up in her throat.
The runestone shook in her hand, and light danced in patches over the prisoner. She saw emaciated arms and legs, scarred all over with the marks of countless tortures. The skull of a face turned toward her, black empty sockets where the eyes should have been, and then there was a dry rustle, and she saw that what she had thought was a white rag were wings. White wings, rising up behind his back in two pure white crescents, the only pure things in this filthy room. She gave a dry gasp.
Jace, do you see?
I see.
Jace, standing beside her, spoke in a voice that cracked like broken glass.
You said there weren't any angels, that no one had ever seen one.
Jace was whispering something under his breath, a string of what sounded like panicked curses. He stumbled forward toward the huddled creature on the floor and recoiled as if he had bounced off an invisible wall. Looking down, Clary saw that the angel crouched inside a pentagram made of connected runes graven deeply into the floor. They glowed with a faint, phosphorescent light.
The runes, she whispered. We can't get past.
But there must be something, Jace said, his voice nearly breaking. Something we can do.
The angel raised its head. Clary saw with a distracted, terrible pity that it had curly golden hair like Jace's that shone dully in the light. Tendrils clung close to the hollows of its skull. Its eyes were pits. Its face slashed with scars like a beautiful painting destroyed by vandals. As she stared, its mouth opened and a sound poured from its throat. Not words, but a piercing golden music. A single singing note, held and held and held so high and sweet that the sound was like pain. A flood of images rose up before Clary's eyes. She was still clutching the runestone, but its light was gone. She was gone, no longer there but somewhere else, where the pictures of the past flowed before her in a waking dream, fragments, colors, sounds. She was in a wine cellar, bare and clean, a single huge rune scrawled on the stone floor. A man stood beside it. He held an open book in one hand and a blazing white torch in the other. When he raised his head, Clary saw that it was Valentine. Much younger, his face unlined and handsome, his dark eyes clear and bright. As he chanted, the rune blazed up into fire, and when the flames receded, a crumpled figure lay among the ashes. An angel, wings spread and bloody, like a bird shot out of the sky. The scene changed.
Valentine stood by a window. At his side, a young woman with shining red hair. A familiar silver ring gleamed on his hand as he reached to put his arms around her. With a jolt of pain, Clary recognized her mother. But she was young, her features soft and vulnerable. She was wearing a white nightgown and was obviously pregnant.
"The Accords," Valentine was saying angrily, "were not just the worst idea the Clave has ever had, but the worst thing that could happen to Nephilim. That we should be bound to Downworlders, tied to those creatures."
"Valentine," Jocelyn said with a smile, "enough about politics, please." She reached up and twined her arms around Valentine's neck, her expression full of love. And his was as well. But there was something else in it. Something that sent a shiver down Clary's spine. Valentine knelt in the center of a circle of trees. There was a bright moon overhead illuminating the black pentagram that had been scrawled into the scraped earth of the clearing. The branches of trees made a thick net overhead. Where they extended above the edge of the pentagram, their leaves curled and turned black. In the center of the five-pointed star sat a woman with long, shining hair. Her shape was slim and lovely, her face hidden in shadow, her arms bare and white. Her left hand was extended in front of her, and as she opened her fingers, Clary could see that there was a long slash across her palm, dripping a slow stream of blood into a silver cup that rested on the pentagram's edge. The blood looked black in the moonlight, or perhaps it was black.
"The child born with this blood in him," she said, and her voice was soft and lovely, "will exceed in power the greater demons of the abysses between the worlds. He will be more mighty than the Asmodei, stronger than the Shadow of the Storms. If he is properly trained, there is nothing he will not be able to do. Though I warn you," she added, "it will burn out his humanity as poison burns a life from the blood."
"My thanks to you, Lady of Edom," said Valentine.
And as he reached to take the cup of blood, the woman lifted her face, and Clary saw that though she was otherwise beautiful, her eyes were hollow black holes from which curled waving black tentacles like feelers probing the air. Clary stifled a scream. The night, the forest, vanished. Jocelyn stood facing someone Clary couldn't see. She was no longer pregnant, and her bright hair straggled around her stricken, despairing face.
"I can't stay with him, Ragnar," she said. "Not for another day. I read his book. Do you know what he did to Jonathan? I didn't think even Valentine could do that."
Her shoulders shook.
"He used demon blood. Jonathan's not a baby anymore. He isn't even human. He's a monster."
She vanished. Valentine was pacing restlessly around the circle of runes, a seraph blade shining in his hand.
"Why won't you speak?" he muttered. "Why won't you give me what I want?"
He drove down with the knife, and the angel writhed as golden liquid poured from its wound like spilled sunlight.
"If you won't give me answers," Valentine hissed, "you can give me your blood. It will do me and mine more good than it will you."
Now they were in the Wayland Library. Sunlight shone through the diamond-paned windows, flooding the room with blue and green. Voices came from another room, the sounds of laughter and chatting. A party going on. Jocelyn knelt by the bookshelf, glancing from side to side. She drew a thick book from her pocket and slipped it onto the shelf. And she was gone. The scene showed a cellar. The same cellar that Clary knew she was standing in right now. The same scrawled pentagram scarred the floor, and within the center of the star lay the angel. Valentine stood by, once again with the burning seraph blade in his hand. He looked years older now, no longer a young man.
"Ithuriel," he said, "we are old friends now, aren't we? I could have left you buried alive under those ruins, but no, I brought you here with me. All these years I've kept you close, hoping one day you would tell me what I wanted, needed to know."
He came closer, holding the blade out, its blaze lighting the runic barrier to a shimmer.
When I summoned you, I dreamed that you would tell me why. Why Raziel created us, his race of shadow hunters, yet did not give us the powers downworlders have, the speed of the wolves, the immortality of the fair folk, the magic of warlocks, even the endurance of vampires. He left us naked before the hosts of hell but for these painted lines on our skin. Why should their powers be greater than ours? Why can't we share in what they have? How is that just? Within its imprisoning star, the angel sat silent as a marble statue, unmoving, its wings folded. Its eyes expressed nothing beyond a terrible, silent sorrow. Valentine's mouth twisted. Very well. Keep your silence. I will have my chance. Valentine lifted the blade. I have the mortal cup, Ithuriel, and soon I shall have the sword. But without the mirror, I cannot begin the summoning. The mirror is all I need. Tell me where it is. Tell me where it is, Ithuriel, and I will let you die. The scene broke apart in fragments, and as her vision faded, Clary caught glimpses of images now familiar to her from her own nightmares. Angels with wings, both white and black, sheets of mirrored water, gold and blood, and Jace, turning away from her, always turning away. Clary reached out for him, and for the first time the angel's voice spoke in her head in words that she could understand. These are not the first dreams I have ever showed you. The image of a rune burst behind her eyes like fireworks. Not a rune she had ever seen before. It was as strong, simple, and straightforward as a tied knot. It was gone in a breath as well, and as it vanished, the angel singing ceased. Clary was back in her own body, reeling on her feet in the filthy and reeking room. The angel was silent, frozen, wings folded, a grieving effigy. Clary let out her breath in a sob. Ithuriel. She reached her hands out to the angel, knowing she couldn't pass the runes, her heart aching. For years the angel had been down here, sitting silent and alone in the blackness, chained and starving but unable to die. Jace was beside her. She could see from his stricken face that he'd seen everything she had. He looked down at the seraph blade in his hand and then back at the angel. Its blind face was turned toward them in silent supplication. Jace took a step forward, and then another. His eyes were fixed on the angel, and it was as if, Clary thought, there were some silent communication passing between them, some speech she couldn't hear. Jace's eyes were bright as gold disks, full of reflected light. Ithuriel, he whispered. The blade in his hand blazed up like a torch. Its glow was blinding. The angel raised its face as if the light were visible to its blind eyes. It reached out its hands, the chains that bound its wrists rattling like harsh music. Jace turned to her. Clary, he said. The runes. The runes. For a moment she stared at him, puzzled, but his eyes urged her onward. She handed Jace the witchlight, took his stele from her pocket, and knelt down by the scrawled runes. They looked as if they'd been gouged into the stone with something sharp. She glanced up at Jace. His expression startled her, the blaze in his eyes. They were full of faith in her, of confidence in her abilities. With the tip of the stele, she traced several lines into the floor, changing the runes of binding to runes of release, imprisonment to openness. They flared up as she traced them, as if she were dragging a match tip across sulfur. Done. She rose to her feet. The runes shimmered before her. Abruptly, Jace moved to stand beside her. The witchlight stone was gone, the only illumination coming from the seraph blade that he'd named for the angel, blazing in his hand. He stretched it out, and this time his hand passed through the barrier of the runes as if there were nothing there. The angel reached its hands up and took the blade from him. It shut its blind eyes, and Clary thought for a moment that it smiled. It turned the blade in its grasp until the sharp tip rested just below its breastbone. Clary gave a little gasp and moved forward, but Jace grabbed her arm, his grip like iron, and yanked her backward.
just as the angel drove the blade home. The angel's head fell back, its hands dropping from the hilt, which protruded from just where its heart would be if angels had hearts. Clary didn't know. Flames burst from the wound, spreading outward from the blade. The angel's body shimmered into white flame, the chains on its wrist burning scarlet, like iron left too long in a fire. Clary thought of medieval paintings of saints consumed in the blaze of holy ecstasy, and the angel's wings flew wide and white before they too caught and blazed up, a lattice of shimmering fire. Clary could no longer watch. She turned and buried her face in Jace's shoulder. His arms came around her, his grip tight and hard. "It's all right," he said into her hair. "It's all right." But the air was full of smoke and the ground felt like it was rocking under her feet. It was only when Jace stumbled that she realized it wasn't shock. The ground was moving. She let go of Jace and staggered. The stones underfoot were grinding together, and a thin rain of dirt was sifting down from the ceiling. The angel was a pillar of smoke. The runes around it glowed painfully bright. Clary stared at them, decoding their meaning, and then looked wildly at Jace. The manor. It was tied to Ethereal. If the angel dies, the manor... She didn't finish her sentence. He had already seized her hand and was running for the stairs, pulling her along after him. The stairs themselves were surging and buckling. Clary fell, banging her knee painfully on a step, but Jace's grip on her arm didn't loosen. She raced on, ignoring the pain in her leg, her lungs full of choking dust. They reached the top of the steps and exploded out into the library. Behind them, Clary could hear the soft roar as the rest of the stairs collapsed. It wasn't much better here. The room was shuddering, books tumbling from their shelves. A statue lay where it had tipped over in a pile of jagged shards. Jace let go of Clary's hand, seized up a chair, and before she could ask him what he meant to do, threw it at the stained glass window. It sailed through in a waterfall of broken glass. Jace turned and held his hand out to her. Behind him, through the jagged frame that remained, she could see a moonlight-saturated stretch of grass and a line of treetops in the distance. They seemed a long way down. "I can't jump that far," she thought, and was about to shake her head at Jace when she saw his eyes widen, his mouth shaping a warning. One of the heavy marble busts that lined the higher shelves had slid free and was falling toward her. She ducked out of its way, and it hit the floor inches from where she'd been standing, leaving a sizable dent in the floor. A second later, Jace's arms were around her, and he was lifting her off her feet. She was too surprised to struggle as he carried her over to the broken window and dumped her unceremoniously out of it. She hit a grassy rise just below the window and tumbled down its steep incline, gaining speed until she fetched up against a hillock with enough force to knock the breath out of her. She sat up, shaking grass out of her hair. A second later, Jace came to a stop next to her. Unlike her, he rolled immediately into a crouch, staring up the hill at the manor house. Clary turned to look where he was looking, but he'd already grabbed her, shoving her down into the depression between the two hills. Later, she'd find dark bruises on her upper arms where he'd held her. Now, she just gasped in surprise as he knocked her down and rolled on top of her, shielding her with his body as a huge roar went up. It sounded like the earth shattering apart, like a volcano erupting. A blast of white dust shot into the sky. Clary heard a sharp pattering noise all around her. For a bewildered moment, she thought it had started to rain. Then she realized it was rubble and dirt and broken glass, the detritus of the shattered manor being flung down around them like deadly hail. Jace pressed her harder into the ground, his body flat against hers, his heartbeat nearly as loud in her ears as the sound of the manor's subsiding ruins. The roar of the collapse faded slowly, like smoke dissipating into the air. It was replaced by the loud chirruping of startled birds. Clary could see them over Jace's shoulder, circling curiously against the dark sky. "Jace," she said softly, "I think I dropped your stele somewhere." He drew back slightly, propping himself on his elbows, and looked down at her. Even in the darkness, she could see herself reflected in his eyes. His face was streaked with soot and dirt, the collar of his shirt torn. "That's all right, as long as you're not hurt." "I'm fine." Without thinking, she reached up,
her fingers brushing lightly through his hair. She felt him tense, his eyes darkening.
There was grass in your hair, she said.
Her mouth was dry. Adrenaline sang through her veins. Everything that had just happened, the angel, the shattering manner, seemed less real than what she saw in Jace's eyes.
You shouldn't touch me, he said.
Her hand froze where it was, her palm against his cheek. Why not?
You know why, he said, and shifted away from her, rolling onto his back. You saw what I saw, didn't you? The past, the angel, our parents.
It was the first time, she thought, that he'd called them that.
Our parents.
She turned onto her side, wanting to reach out to him, but not sure if she should. He was staring blindly up at the sky. I saw.
You know what I am.
The words breathed out in an anguished whisper. I'm part demon, Clary.
Part demon. You understood that much, didn't you?
His eyes bored into her like drills.
You saw what Valentine was trying to do. He used demon blood. Used it on me before I was even born. I'm part monster. Part everything I've tried so hard to burn out, to destroy.
Clary pushed away the memory of Valentine's voice saying,
She left me because I turned her first child into a monster.
But warlocks are part demon, like Magnus. It doesn't make them evil.
Not part greater demon. You heard what the demon woman said.
It will burn out his humanity as poison burns the life from the blood. Clary's voice trembled. It's not true. It can't be. It doesn't make sense.
But it does.
There was a furious desperation in Jace's expression. She could see the gleam of the silver chain around his bare throat, lit to a white flare by the starlight.
It explains everything.
You mean it explains why you're such an amazing shadow hunter?
Why you're loyal and fearless and honest and everything demons aren't?
It explains, he said evenly, why I feel the way I do about you.
What do you mean? He was silent for a long moment, staring at her across the tiny space that separated them. She could feel him, even though he wasn't touching her, as if he still lay with his body against hers.
You're my sister, he said finally. My sister, my blood, my family. I should want to protect you.
He laughed, soundlessly and without any humor.
To protect you from the sort of boys who want to do with you exactly what I want to do.
Clary's breath caught. You said you just wanted to be my brother from now on.
I lied, he said. Demons lie, Clary. You know, there are some kinds of wounds you can get when you're a shadow hunter. Internal injuries from demon poison. You don't even know what's wrong with you, but you're bleeding to death slowly inside. That's what it's like, just being your brother.
But Aline...
I had to try, and I did.
His voice was lifeless.
But God knows I don't want anyone but you. I don't even want to want anyone but you.
He reached out, trailed his fingers lightly through her hair, fingertips brushing her cheek.
Now at least I know why.
Clary's voice had sunk to a whisper. I don't want anyone but you either. She was rewarded by the catch in his breathing. Slowly, he drew himself up onto his elbows. Now he was looking down at her, and his expression had changed. There was a look on his face she'd never seen before, a sleepy, almost deadly light in his eyes. He let his fingers trail down her cheeks to her lips, outlining the shape of her mouth with the tip of a finger.
You should probably, he said, tell me not to do this.
She said nothing. She didn't want to tell him to stop. She was tired of saying no to Jace, of never letting herself feel what her whole heart wanted to feel, whatever the cost. He bent down, his lips against her cheek, brushing it lightly, and still that light touch sent shivers through her nerves, shivers that made her whole body tremble.
If you want me to stop, tell me now, he whispered.
When she still said nothing, he brushed his mouth against the hollow of her temple.
Or now?
He traced the line of her cheekbone.
Or now.
His lips were against hers.
Or.
But she had reached up and pulled him down to her, and the rest of his words were lost against her mouth. He kissed her gently, carefully, but it wasn't gentleness she wanted, not now. Not after all this time, and she knotted her fists in his shirt, pulling him harder against her. He groaned softly, low in his throat, and then his arms circled her, gathering her against him, and they rolled over on the grass, tangled together, still kissing. There were rocks digging into Clary's back, and her shoulder ached where she'd fallen from the window, but she didn't care. All that existed was Jace. All she felt, hoped, breathed, wanted, and saw was Jace. Nothing else mattered. Despite her coat, she could feel the heat of him burning through his clothes and hers. She tugged his jacket off, and then somehow his shirt was off too. Her fingers explored his body as his mouth explored hers. Soft skin over lean muscle, scars like thin wires. She touched the star-shaped scar on his shoulder. It was smooth and flat, as if it were part of his skin, not raised like his other scars. She supposed they were imperfections, these marks, but they didn't feel that way to her. They were a history, cut into his body, the map of a life of endless war. He fumbled with the buttons of her coat, his hands shaking. She didn't think she'd ever seen Jace's hands unsteady before. "I'll do it," she said, and reached for the last button herself. As she raised herself up, something cold and metallic struck her collarbone, and she gasped in surprise.
"What is it?" Jace froze. "Did I hurt you?"
"No, it was this." She touched the silver chain around his neck. On its end hung a small silver circle of metal. It had bumped against her when she'd leaned forward. She stared at it now. That ring, the weather-beaten metal with its pattern of stars, she knew that ring. The Morgenstern ring. It was the same ring that had gleamed on Valentine's hand in the dream the angel had showed them. It had been his, and he had given it to Jace, as it had always been passed along father to son.
"I'm sorry," Jace said.
He traced the line of her cheek with his fingertip, a dreamlike intensity in his gaze.
"I forgot I was wearing the damn thing."
Sudden cold flooded Clary's veins. "Jace," she said in a low voice. "Jace, don't."
"Don't what? Don't wear the ring?"
"No, don't touch me. Stop for a second." His face went still. Questions had chased away the dreamlike confusion in his eyes, but he said nothing, just withdrew his hand. "Jace," she said again. "Why? Why now?" His lips parted in surprise. She could see a dark line where he had bitten his bottom lip, or maybe she had bitten it.
"Why what now?"
"You said there was nothing between us. That if we let ourselves feel what we might want to feel, we'd be hurting everyone we care about."
"I told you. I was lying."
His eyes softened. "You think I don't want to?" "No," she said. "No, I'm not stupid. I know that you do. But when you said that now, you finally understand why you feel this way about me. What do you mean?" Not that she didn't know, she thought, but she had to ask, had to hear him say it. Jace caught her wrists and drew her hands up to his face, lacing his fingers through hers.
"You remember what I said to you at the Panhollow's house?" he asked. "That you never think about what you do before you do it, and that's why you wreck everything you touch?"
"No, I'd forgotten that. Thanks for the reminder." He barely seemed to notice the sarcasm in her voice.
"I wasn't talking about you, Clary. I was talking about me. That's what I'm like."
He turned his face slightly and her finger slid along his cheek.
"At least now I know why. I know what's wrong with me, and maybe that's why I need you so much. Because if Valentine made me a monster, then I suppose he made you a sort of angel. And Lucifer loved God, didn't he? So says Milton, anyway."
Clary sucked in her breath.
"I am not an angel. And you don't even know that that's what Valentine used Ethereal's blood for. Maybe Valentine just wanted it for himself."
"He said the blood was for me and mine," Jay said quietly. "It explains why you can do what you can do, Clary. The Sealy Queen said we were both experiments, not just me."
"I'm not an angel, Jace," she repeated. "I don't return library books. I steal illegal music off the internet. I lie to my mom. I am completely ordinary."
"Not to me."
He looked down at her. His face hovered against a background of stars. There was nothing of his usual arrogance in his expression. She had never seen him look so unguarded, but even that unguardedness was mixed with a self-hatred that ran as deep as a wound.
Clary, I... Get off me, Clary said.
What?
The desire in his eyes cracked into a thousand pieces like the shards of the portal mirror at Renwick's, and for a moment his expression was blankly astonished. She could hardly bear to look at him and still say no. Looking at him now, even if she hadn't been in love with him, that part of her that was her mother's daughter, that loved every beautiful thing for its beauty alone, would still have wanted him. But then, it was precisely because she was her mother's daughter that it was impossible.
You heard me, she said, and leave my hands alone.
She snatched them back, knotting them into tight fists to stop their shaking. He didn't move. His lip curled back, and for a moment she saw that predatory light in his eyes, but now it was mixed with anger.
I don't suppose you want to tell me why?
You think you only want me because you're evil, not human. You just want something else you can hate yourself for. I won't let you use me to prove to yourself how worthless you are.
I never said that. I never said I was using you.
Fine, she said. Tell me now that you're not a monster. Tell me there's nothing wrong with you. And tell me you would want me even if you didn't have demon blood.
Because I don't have demon blood, and I still want you.
Their gazes locked, his blindly furious. For a moment, neither breathed, and then he flung himself off her, swearing, and rolled to his feet. Snatching his shirt up from the grass, he drew it over his head, still glaring. He yanked the shirt down over his jeans and turned away to look for his jacket. Clary stood up, staggering a little. The stinging wind raised goosebumps on her arms. Her legs felt like they were made of half-melted wax. She did up the buttons on her coat with numb fingers, fighting the urge to burst into tears. Crying wouldn't help anything now. The air was still full of dancing dust and ash, the grass all around scattered with debris, shattered bits of furniture, the pages of books blowing mournfully in the wind, splinters of gilded wood, a chunk of almost half a staircase, mysteriously unharmed. Clary turned to look at Jace. He was kicking bits of debris with a savage satisfaction.
Well, he said, we're screwed.
It wasn't what she'd expected. She blinked.
What? Remember, you lost my stele? There's no chance of you drawing a portal now.
He spoke the words with a bitter pleasure, as if the situation satisfied him in some obscure way.
We've got no other way of getting back. We're going to have to walk.
It wouldn't have been a pleasant walk under normal circumstances. Accustomed to city lights, Clary couldn't believe how dark it was in Idris at night. The thick black shadows that lined the road on either side seemed to be crawling with barely visible things, and even with Jace's witchlight, she could see only a few feet ahead of them. She missed streetlights, the ambient glow of headlights, the sounds of the city. All she could hear now was the steady crunch of their boots on gravel and, every once in a while, her own breath puffing out in surprise as she tripped over a stray rock. After a few hours, her feet began to ache and her mouth was dry as parchment. The air had grown very cold and she hunched along shivering, her hands thrust deep into her pockets. But even all that would have been bearable if only Jace had been talking to her. He hadn't spoken a word since they'd left the manor, except to snap out directions, telling her which way to turn at a fork in the road, or ordering her to skirt a pothole. Even then, she doubted if he would have minded much if she'd fallen into the pothole, except that it would have slowed them down. Eventually the sky in the east began to lighten. Clary, stumbling along half asleep, raised her head in surprise. It's early for dawn. Jace looked at her with bland contempt.
That's Alicante. The sun doesn't come up for another 3 hours at least. Those are the city lights.
Too relieved that they were nearly home to mind his attitude, Clary picked up her pace. They rounded a corner and found themselves walking along a wide dirt path cut into a hillside. It snaked along the curve of the slope, disappearing around a bend in the distance. Though the city was not yet visible, the air had grown brighter, the sky shot through with a peculiar reddish glow.
We must be nearly there, Clary said. Is there a shortcut down the hill?
Jace was frowning.
Something's wrong, he said abruptly. He took off, half running down the road,
his boots sending up puffs of dust that gleamed ochre in the strange light. Clary ran to keep pace, ignoring the protests of her blistered feet. They rounded the next curve and Jace skidded to a sudden halt, sending Clary crashing into him. In another circumstance, it might have been comic. It wasn't now. The reddish light was stronger now, throwing a scarlet glow up into the night sky, lighting the hill they stood on as if it were daylight. Plumes of smoke curled up from the valley below like the unfurling feathers of a black peacock. Rising from the black vapor were the demon towers of Alicante, their crystalline shells like arrows of fire piercing the smoky air. Through the thick smoke, Clary could glimpse the leaping scarlet of flames, scattered across the city like a handful of glittering jewels across a dark cloth. It seemed incredible, but there it was. They were standing on a hillside high over Alicante, and below them, the city was burning. Part 2. Stars Shine Darkly. Antonio, will you stay no longer? Nor will you not that I go with you? Sebastian, by your patience, no. My stars shine darkly over me. The malignancy of my fate might, perhaps, distemper yours. Therefore, I shall crave of you your leave that I may bear my evils alone. It were a bad recompense for your love to lay any of them on you. William Shakespeare, Twelfth Night. Chapter 10. Fire and Sword. It's late, Isabel said, fretfully twitching the lace curtain across the high living room window back into place. He ought to be back by now. Be reasonable, Isabel, Alec pointed out in that superior big brother tone that seemed to imply that while she, Isabel, might be prone to hysteria, he, Alec, was always perfectly calm. Even his posture. He was lounging in one of the overstuffed armchairs next to the Penhallows fireplace as if he didn't have a care in the world. Seemed designed to show off how unworried he was. Jace does this when he's upset. Goes off and wanders around. He said he was going for a walk. He'll be back. Isabel sighed. She almost wished her parents were there, but they were still up at the guard. Whatever the Clave was discussing, the council meeting was dragging on brutally late. But he knows New York. He doesn't know Alicante. He probably knows it better than you do. Aline was sitting on the couch reading a book, its pages bound in dark red leather. Her black hair was pulled behind her head in a French braid, her eyes fastened on the volume spread across her lap. Isabel, who had never been much of a reader, always envied other people their ability to get lost in a book. There were a lot of things she once would have envied Aline for. Being small and delicately pretty, for one thing. Not Amazonian, and so tall in heels, she towered over almost every boy she met. But then again, it was only recently that Isabel had realized other girls weren't just for envying, avoiding, or disliking. He lived here until he was 10. You guys have only visited a few times. Isabel raised her hand to her throat with a frown. The pendant slung on the chain around her neck had given a sudden, sharp pulse. But it normally only pulsed in the presence of demons, and they were in Alicante. There was no way there were demons nearby. Maybe the pendant was malfunctioning. I don't think he's wandering around, anyway. I think it's pretty obvious where he went, Isabel responded. Alec raised his eyes. You think he went to see Clary? Is she still here? I thought she was supposed to be going back to New York. Aline let her book fall closed. Where is Jace's sister staying, anyway? Isabel shrugged. Ask him, she said, cutting her eyes toward Sebastian. Sebastian was sprawled on the couch opposite Aline's. He had a book in his hand, too, and his dark head was bent over it. He raised his eyes as if he could feel Isabel's gaze on him.
Were you talking about me? He asked mildly.
Everything about Sebastian was mild, Isabel thought with a twinge of annoyance. She'd been impressed by his looks at first. Those sharply planed cheekbones and those black, fathomless eyes, but his affable, sympathetic personality grated on her now. She didn't like boys who looked as if they never got mad about anything. In Isabel's world, rage equaled passion equaled a good time. What are you reading? She asked, more sharply than she'd meant to. Is that one of Max's comic books?
Yep.
Sebastian looked down at the copy of Angel Sanctuary balanced on the sofa's arm.
I like the pictures.
Isabel blew out an exasperated breath. Shooting her a look, Alex said, "Sebastian, earlier today, does Jace know where you went?"
"You mean that I was out with Clary?"
Sebastian looked amused.
"Look, it's not a secret. I would have told Jace if I'd seen him since.
I don't know why he would care." Aline put her book aside, an edge to her voice. "It's not like Sebastian did anything wrong. So what if he wants to show Clarissa some of Idris before she goes home? Jace ought to be pleased his sister isn't sitting around bored and annoyed."
"He can be very protective," Alex said after a slight hesitation.
Aline frowned. "He should back off. It can't be good for her being so overprotected. The look on her face when she walked in on us, it was like she'd never seen anyone kissing before. I mean, who knows, maybe she hasn't."
"She has," Isabel said, thinking of the way Jace had kissed Clary in the Seely court.
It wasn't something she liked to think about. Isabel didn't enjoy wallowing in her own sorrows, much less other people's.
"It's not that."
"Then what is it?" Sebastian straightened up, pushing a lock of dark hair out of his eyes. Isabel caught a flash of something, a red line across his palm like a scar.
"Is it just that he hates me personally, because I don't know what it is I ever..."
"That's my book." A small voice interrupted Sebastian's speech. It was Max, standing in the living room doorway. He was wearing gray pajamas, and his brown hair was disarrayed as if he'd just woken up. He was glaring at the manga novel sitting next to Sebastian.
"What, this?"
Sebastian held the copy of Angel Sanctuary.
"Here you go, kid."
Max stalked across the room and snatched the book back. He scowled at Sebastian.
"Don't call me kid."
Sebastian laughed and stood up.
"I'm getting some coffee," he said, and headed for the kitchen.
He paused and turned in the doorway.
"Does anyone want anything?"
There was a chorus of refusals. With a shrug, Sebastian disappeared into the kitchen, letting the door swing shut behind him.
"Max," Isabel said sharply, "don't be rude."
"I don't like it when people take my stuff." Max hugged the comic book to his chest.
"Grow up, Max. He was just borrowing it."
Isabel's voice came out more irritably than she'd intended. She was still worried about Jace, she knew, and was taking it out on her little brother.
"You should be in bed anyway. It's late."
"There were noises up on the hill. They woke me up." Max blinked. Without his glasses, everything was pretty much a blur to him.
"Isabel?"
The questioning note in his voice got her attention. Isabel turned away from the window.
"What?"
"Do people ever climb the demon towers? Like, for any reason?" Aline looked up.
"Climb the demon towers?" She laughed.
"No, no one ever does that. It's totally illegal, for one thing, and besides, why would you want to?" Aline, Isabel thought, did not have much imagination. She herself could think of lots of reasons why someone might want to climb the demon towers, if only to spit gum down on passers-by below. Max was frowning.
"But someone did. I know, I saw."
"Whatever you think you saw, you probably dreamed it," Isabel told him. Max's face creased. Sensing a potential meltdown, Alex stood up and held out a hand.
"Come on, Max," he said, not without affection. "Let's get you back to bed."
"We should all get to bed," Aline said, standing up. She came over to the window beside Isabel and drew the curtains firmly shut.
"It's already almost midnight. Who knows when they'll get back from the council? There's no point staying."
The pendant on Isabel's throat pulsed again, sharply, and then the window Aline was standing in front of shattered inward. Aline screamed as hands reached through the gaping hole. Not hands, really, Isabel saw with the clarity of shock, but huge, scaled claws streaked with blood and blackish fluid. They seized Aline and yanked her through the smashed window before she could utter a second scream. Isabel's whip was lying on the table by the fireplace. She dashed for it now, ducking around Sebastian, who had come racing out of the kitchen.
"Get weapons," she snapped as he stared around the room in astonishment.
"Go!" she shrieked and ran for the window. By the fireplace, Alec was holding Max as the younger boy squirmed and yelled, trying to wriggle out of his brother's grip. Alec dragged him toward the door.
"Good," Isabel thought. "Get Max out of here."
Cold air blew through the shattered window. Isabel pulled her skirt up and kicked out the rest of the broken glass, thankful for the thick soles of her boots. When the glass was gone, she ducked her head and jumped out through the gaping hole in the frame, landing with a jolt on the stone walkway below. At first glance, the walkway looked empty. There were no streetlights along the canal. The main illumination here came from the windows of nearby houses. Isabel moved forward cautiously, her electrum whip coiled at her side. She had owned the whip for so long. It had been a 12th birthday present from her father, that it felt like part of her now, like a fluid extension of her right arm. The shadows thickened as she moved away from the house and toward Old Castle Bridge, which arched over the Princewater Canal at an odd angle to the walkway. The shadows at its base were clustered as thickly as black flies, and then, as Isabel stared, something moved within the shadow, something white and darting. Isabel ran, crashing through a low border of hedges at the end of someone's garden and hopping down onto the narrow brick causeway that ran below the bridge. Her whip had begun to glow with a harsh silvery light, and in its faint illumination she could see Aline lying limply at the edge of the canal. A massive scaled demon was sprawled on top of her, pressing her down with the weight of its thick lizard-like body, its face buried in her neck. But it couldn't be a demon. There had never been demons in Alicante. Never. As Isabel stared in shock, the thing raised its head and sniffed the air as if sensing her there. It was blind, she saw, a thick line of serrated teeth running like a zipper across its forehead where eyes should be. It had another mouth on the lower half of its face as well, fanged with dripping tusks. The sides of its narrow tail glittered as it whipped back and forth, and Isabel saw, drawing closer, that the tail was edged with razor-sharp lines of bone. Aline twitched and made a noise, a gasping whimper. Relief spilled over Isabel. She'd been half sure Aline was dead, but it was short-lived. As Aline moved, Isabel saw that her blouse had been sliced open down the front. There were claw marks on her chest, and the thing had another claw hooked into the waistband of her jeans. A wave of nausea rolled over Isabel. The demon wasn't trying to kill Aline. Not yet. Isabel's whip came alive in her hand like the flaming sword of an avenging angel. She launched herself forward, her whip slashing down across the demon's back. The demon screeched and rolled off Aline. It advanced on Isabel, its two mouths gaping, talons slashing toward her face. Dancing backward, she threw the whip forward again. It slashed across the demon's face, its chest, its legs. A myriad of crisscrossing lash marks sprang up across the demon's scaled skin, dripping blood and ichor. A long, forked tongue shot from its upper mouth, probing for Isabel's face. There was a bulb on the end of it, she saw, a sort of stinger, like a scorpion's. She flicked her wrist to the side, and the whip curled around the demon's tongue, roping it with bands of flexible electrum. The demon screamed and screamed as she pulled the knot tight and jerked. The demon's tongue fell with a wet, sickening thump to the bricks of the causeway. Isabel jerked the whip back. The demon turned and fled, moving with quick, darting motions like a snake. Isabel darted after it. The demon was halfway to the path that led up from the causeway when a dark shape rose up in front of it. Something flashed in the darkness and the demon fell twitching to the ground. Isabel came to an abrupt stop. Aline stood over the fallen demon, a slender dagger in her hand. She must have been wearing it on her belt. The runes on the blade shone like flashing lightning as she drove the dagger down, plunging it over and over into the demon's twitching body until the thing stopped moving entirely and vanished. Aline looked up. Her face was blank. She made no move to hold her blouse closed despite its torn buttons. Blood oozed from the deep scratch marks on her chest. Isabel let out a low whistle. "Aline, are you all right?" Aline let the dagger fall to the ground with a clatter. Without another word, she turned and ran, disappearing into the darkness under the bridge. Caught by surprise, Isabel swore and dashed after Aline. She wished she'd worn something more practical than a velvet dress tonight, although at least she'd put her boots on. She doubted she could have caught up to Aline wearing heels. There were metal stairs on the other side of the causeway leading back up to Princewater Street. Aline was a blur at the top of the stairway. Hiking up the heavy hem of her dress, Isabel followed, her boots clattering on the steps. When she reached the top, she looked around for Aline. and stared. She was standing at the foot of the broad road on which the Penhallows' house fronted. She could no longer see Aline. The other girl had disappeared into the churning throng of people crowding the street. And not just people, either. There were things in the street. Demons. Dozens of them, maybe more. Like the taloned lizard creature Aline had dispatched under the bridge. Two or three bodies lay in the street already, one only a few feet from Isabel, a man, half his ribcage torn away. Isabel could see from his gray hair that he'd been elderly. But of course he was, she thought, her brain ticking over slowly, the speed of her thoughts dulled by panic. All the adults were in the guard. Down in the city were only children, the old, and the sick. The red-tinged air was full of the smell of burning, the night split by shrieks and screams. Doors were open all up and down the rows of houses. People were darting out of them, then stopping dead as they saw the street filled with monsters. It was impossible, unimaginable. Never in history had a single demon crossed the wards of the Demon Towers. And now there were dozens, hundreds, maybe more, flooding the streets like a poisonous tide. Isabel felt as if she were trapped behind a glass wall, able to see everything but unable to move, watching, frozen, as a demon seized a fleeing boy and lifted him bodily off the ground, sinking its serrated teeth into his shoulder. The boy screamed, but his screams were lost in the clamor that was tearing the night apart. The sound rose and rose in volume. The howling of demons, people calling one another's names, the sounds of running feet and shattering glass. Someone down the street was shouting words she could barely understand, something about the Demon Towers. Isabel looked up. The tall spires stood sentry over the city as they always had, but instead of reflecting the silver light of the stars or even the red light of the burning city, they were as dead white as the skin of a corpse. Their luminescence had vanished. A chill ran through her. No wonder the streets were full of monsters. Somehow, impossibly, the Demon Towers had lost their magic. The wards that had protected Alicante for 1,000 years were gone. Samuel had fallen silent hours ago, but Simon was still awake, staring sleeplessly into the darkness when he heard the screaming. His head jerked up. Silence. He looked around uneasily. Had he dreamed the noise? He strained his ears. But even with his newly sensitive hearing, nothing was audible. He was about to lie back down when the screams came again, driving into his ears like needles. It sounded as if they were coming from outside the guard. Rising, he stood on the bed and looked out the window. He saw the green lawn stretching away, the faraway light of the city, a faint glow in the distance. He narrowed his eyes. There was something wrong about the city light, something off. It was dimmer than he remembered it, and there were moving points here and there in the darkness like needles of fire weaving through the streets. A pale cloud rose above the towers, and the air was full of the stench of smoke. Samuel. Simon could hear the alarm in his own voice. There's something wrong. He heard doors slamming open and running feet. Hoarse voices shouted. Simon pressed his face close to the bars as pairs of boots hurtled by outside, kicking up stones as they ran, the shadow hunters calling to one another as they raced away from the guard down toward the city. The wards are down! The wards are down! We can't abandon the guard! The guard doesn't matter! Our children are down there! Their voices were already growing fainter. Simon jerked back from the window, gasping. Samuel, the wards!
I know. I heard.
Samuel's voice came strongly through the wall. He didn't sound frightened, but resigned, and even perhaps a little triumphant at being proved right.
Valentine has attacked while the Clave is in session. Clever.
But the guard, it's fortified. Why don't they stay up here?
You heard them. Because all the children are in the city. Children, aged parents, they can't just leave them down there.
The Lightwoods. Simon thought of Jace, and then, with terrible clarity, of Isabel's small, pale face under her crown of dark hair, of her determination in a fight, of the little girl X's and O's on the note she'd written him.
But you told them. You told the Clave what would happen. Why didn't they believe you?
because the wards are their religion. Not to believe in the power of the wards is not to believe that they are special, chosen and protected by the angel. They might as well believe they're just ordinary mundanes.
Simon swung back to stare out the window again, but the smoke had thickened, filling the air with a grayish pallor. He could no longer hear voices shouting outside. There were cries in the distance, but they were very faint.
I think the city is on fire.
No.
Samuel's voice was very quiet.
I think it's the guard that's burning. Probably demon fire. Valentine would go after the guard if he could.
But... Simon's words stumbled over one another.
But someone will come and let us out, won't they? The consul, or Aldertree. They can't just leave us down here to die.
You're a downworlder, said Samuel. And I'm a traitor. Do you really think they're likely to do anything else?
Isabel! Isabel!
Alec had his hands on her shoulders and was shaking her. Isabel raised her head slowly. Her brother's white face floated against the darkness behind him. A curved piece of wood stuck up behind his right shoulder. He had his bow strapped across his back, the same bow that Simon had used to kill Greater Demon Abaddon. She couldn't remember Alec walking toward her, couldn't remember seeing him in the street at all. It was as if he'd materialized in front of her all at once like a ghost. Alec? Her voice came out slow and uneven. Alec, stop, I'm all right. She pulled away from him.
You didn't look all right.
Alec glanced up and cursed under his breath.
We have to get off the street. Where's Aline?
Isabel blinked. There were no demons in view. Someone was sitting on the front steps of the house opposite them and crying in a loud and grating series of shrieks. The old man's body was still in the street, and the smell of demons was everywhere.
Aline, one of the demons tried to... It tried to...
She caught her breath, held it. She was Isabel Lightwood. She did not get hysterical, no matter what the provocation.
We killed it, but then she ran off. I tried to follow her, but she was too fast.
She looked up at her brother.
Demons in the city, she said. How is it possible?
I don't know. Alec shook his head. The wards must be down. There were 4 or 5 Oni demons out here when I came out of the house. I got one lurking by the bushes. The others ran off, but they could come back. Come on, let's get back to the house. The person on the stairs was still sobbing. The sound followed them as they hurried back to the Penhallows' house. The street stayed empty of demons, but they could hear explosions, cries, and running feet echoing from the shadow of other darkened streets. As they climbed the Penhallows' front steps, Isabel glanced back just in time to see a long, snaking tentacle whip out from the darkness between the two houses and snatch the sobbing woman off the front steps. Her sobs turned to shrieks. Isabel tried to turn back, but Alec had already grabbed her and shoved her ahead of him into the house, slamming and locking the front door behind them. The house was dark.
I doused the lights. I didn't want to attract any more of them, Alec explained, pushing Isabel ahead of him into the living room.
Max was sitting on the floor by the stairs, his arms hugging his knees. Sebastian was by the window, nailing logs of wood he'd taken from the fireplace across the gaping hole in the glass.
There, he said, standing back and letting the hammer drop onto the bookshelf. That should hold for a while.
Isabel dropped down by Max and stroked his hair. Are you all right?
No.
His eyes were huge and scared.
I tried to see out the window, but Sebastian told me to get down.
Sebastian was right, Alec said. There were demons out in the street.
Are they still there?
No, but there are some still in the city. We have to think about what we're going to do next. Sebastian was frowning.
Where's Aline?
She ran off, Isabel explained. It was my fault. I should have been...
It was not your fault. Without you, she'd be dead.
Alec spoke in a clipped voice.
Look. We don't have time for self-recriminations. I'm going to go after Aline. I want you three to stay here. Isabel, look after Max. Sebastian, finish securing the house.
Isabel spoke up indignantly.
I don't want you going out there alone. Take me with you.
I'm the adult here. What I say goes.
Alec's tone was even.
There's every chance our parents will be coming back any minute from the guard. The more of us here, the better. It'll be too easy for us to get separated out there. I'm not risking it, Isabel. His glance moved to Sebastian. Do you understand? Sebastian had already taken out his stele. I'll work on warding the house with Marks. Thanks.
Alec was already halfway to the door. He turned and looked back at Isabel. She met his eyes for a split second, then he was gone.
Isabel?
It was Max, his small voice low.
Your wrist is bleeding.
Isabel glanced down. She had no memory of having hurt her wrist, but Max was right. Blood had already stained the sleeve of her white jacket. She got to her feet.
I'm going to get my stele. I'll be right back and help you with the rune, Sebastian.
He nodded.
I could use some help. These aren't my specialty.
Isabel went upstairs without asking him what his specialty might actually be. She felt bone-tired, in dire need of an energy mark. She could do one herself if necessary, though Alec and Jace had always been better at those sort of runes than she was. Once inside her room, she rummaged through her things for her stele and a few extra weapons. As she shoved seraph blades into the tops of her boots, her mind was on Alec and the look they'd shared as he'd gone out the door. It wasn't the first time she'd watched her brother leave, knowing she might never see him again. It was something she accepted, and had always accepted, as part of her life. It wasn't until she'd gotten to know Clary and Simon that she'd realized that for most people, of course, it was never like that. They didn't live with death as a constant companion, a cold breath down the back of their neck on even the most ordinary days. She'd always had such contempt for mundanes, the way all shadow hunters did. She believed that they were soft, stupid, sheep-like in their complacency. Now she wondered if all that hatred didn't just stem from the fact that she was jealous. It must be nice not worrying that every time one of your family members walked out the door, they'd never come back. She was halfway down the stairs, her stele in hand, when she sensed that something was wrong. The living room was empty. Max and Sebastian were nowhere to be seen. There was a half-finished protection mark on one of the logs Sebastian had nailed over the broken window. The hammer he'd used was gone. Her stomach tightened. Max? She shouted, turning in a circle. Sebastian, where are you? Sebastian's voice answered her from the kitchen.
Isabel, in here.
Relief washed over her, leaving her lightheaded. Sebastian, that's not funny, she said, marching into the kitchen. I thought you were... She let the door fall shut behind her. It was dark in the kitchen, darker than it had been in the living room. She strained her eyes to see Sebastian and Max and saw nothing but shadows.
Sebastian?
Uncertainty crept into her voice. Sebastian, what are you doing in here? Where's Max?
Isabel.
She thought she saw something move, a shadow dark against lighter shadows. His voice was soft, kind, almost lovely. She hadn't realized before now what a beautiful voice he had.
Isabel, I'm sorry.
Sebastian, you're acting weird. Stop it.
I'm sorry it's you, he said. See, out of all of them, I liked you the best.
Sebastian?
Out of all of them, he said again in the same low voice. I thought you were the most like me.
He brought his fist down then, with the hammer in it.
Alec raced through the dark and burning streets, calling out over and over for Aline. As he left the Princewater district and entered the heart of the city, his pulse quickened. The streets were like a Bosch painting come to life, full of grotesque and macabre creatures and scenes of sudden, hideous violence. Panicked strangers shoved Alec aside without looking and ran screaming past without any apparent destination. The air stank of smoke and demons. Some of the houses were in flames. Others had their windows knocked out. The cobblestones sparkled with broken glass. As he drew close to one building, he saw that what he'd thought was a discolored patch of paint was a huge swath of fresh blood splattered across the plaster. He spun in place, glancing in every direction, but saw nothing that explained it. Nevertheless, he hurried away as quickly as he could. Alec, alone of all the Lightwood children, remembered Alicante. He'd been a toddler when they left, yet he still carried recollections of the shimmering towers,
the streets full of snow in winter, chains of witchlight wreathing the shops and houses, water splashing in the mermaid fountain in the hall. He had always felt an odd tug at his heart at the thought of Alicante, the half-painful hope that his family would return one day to the place where they belonged. To see the city like this was like the death of all joy. Turning onto a wider boulevard, one of the streets that led down to the Accords Hall, he saw a pack of Belial demons ducking through an archway, hissing and howling. They dragged something behind them, something that twitched and spasmed as it slid over the cobbled street. He darted down the street, but the demons were already gone. Crumpled against the base of a pillar was a limp shape leaking a spidery trail of blood. Broken glass crunched like pebbles under Alec's boots as he knelt to turn the body over. After a single glance at the purple distorted face, he shuddered and drew away, grateful that it was no one he knew. A noise made him scramble to his feet. He smelled the stench before he saw it, the shadow of something humped and huge slithering toward him from the far end of the street. A greater demon? Alec didn't wait to find out. He darted across the street toward one of the taller houses, leaping up onto a sill whose window glass had been smashed in. A few minutes later, he was pulling himself onto the roof, his hands aching, his knees scraped. He got to his feet, brushing grit from his hands, and looked out over Alicante. The ruined demon towers cast their dull, dead light down onto the moving streets of the city, where things loped and crawled and slunk in the shadows between buildings, like roaches skittering through a dark apartment. The air carried cries and shouts, the sound of screaming, names called on the wind, and there were the cries of demons as well, howls of mayhem and delight, shrieks that pierced the human ear like pain. Smoke rose above the honey-colored stone houses in a haze, wreathing the spires of the Hall of Accords. Glancing up toward the guard, Alec saw a flood of shadow hunters racing down the path from the hill, illuminated by the witch lights they carried. The Clave were coming down to battle. He moved to the edge of the roof. The buildings here were very close together, their eaves almost touching. It was easy to jump from this roof to the next, and then to the one after that. He found himself running lightly along the rooftops, jumping the slight distances between houses. It was good to have the cold wind in his face, overpowering the stench of demons. He'd been running for a few minutes before he realized two things. One, he was running toward the white spires of the Accords Hall. And two, there was something up ahead, in a square between two alleys, something that looked like a shower of rising sparks, except that they were blue, a dark gas flame blue. Alec had seen blue sparks like that before. He stared for a moment before he began to run. The roof closest to the square was steeply pitched. Alec skidded down the side of it, his boots knocking against loose shingles. Poised precariously at the edge, he looked down. Cistern Square was below him, and his view was partly blocked by a massive metal pole that jutted out midway down the face of the building he was standing on. A wooden shop sign dangled from it, swaying in the breeze. The square beneath was full of Iblis demons, human-shaped but formed of a substance like coiling black smoke, each with a pair of burning yellow eyes. They had formed a line and were moving slowly toward the lone figure of a man in a sweeping gray coat, forcing him to retreat against a wall. Alec could only stare. Everything about the man was familiar, the lean curve of his back, the wild tangle of his dark hair, and the way that blue fire sprang from his fingertips like darting, cyanotic fireflies. Magnus. The warlock was hurling spears of blue fire at the Iblis demons. One spear struck an advancing demon in the chest. With a sound like a pail of water poured onto flames, it shuddered and vanished in a burst of ash. The others moved to fill his place. Iblis demons weren't very bright, and Magnus hurled another spate of fiery spears. Several Iblis fell, but now another demon, more cunning than the others, had drifted around Magnus and was coalescing behind him, ready to strike. Alec didn't stop to think. Instead, he jumped, catching the edge of the roof as he fell, and then dropped straight down to seize the metal pole and swing himself up and around it, slowing his fall. He released it and dropped lightly to the ground. The demon, startled, began to turn, its yellow eyes like flaming jewels. Alec had time only to reflect that if he were Jace,
He would have had something clever to say before he snatched the seraph blade from his belt and ran it through the demon. With a dusty shriek, the demon vanished, the violence of its exit from this dimension splattering Alec with a fine rain of ash.
Alec?
Magnus was staring at him. He had dispatched the remaining Iblis demons, and the square was empty but for the two of them.
Did you just save my life?
Alec knew he ought to say something like, "Of course, because I'm a shadow hunter and that's what we do," or, "That's my job." Jace would have said something like that. Jace always knew the right thing to say. But the words that actually came out of Alec's mouth were quite different and sounded petulant, even to his own ears.
"You never called me back," he said. "I called you so many times and you never called me back."
Magnus looked at Alec as if he'd lost his mind. "Your city is under attack," he said. "The wards have broken, and the streets are full of demons, and you want to know why I haven't called you?" Alec set his jaw in a stubborn line. "I want to know why you haven't called me back." Magnus threw his hands up in the air in a gesture of utter exasperation. Alec noted with interest that when he did it, a few sparks escaped from his fingertips, like fireflies escaping from a jar. "You're an idiot." "Is that why you didn't call me back? Because I'm an idiot?"
"No,"
Magnus strode toward him. "I didn't call you because I'm tired of you only wanting me around when you need something. I'm tired of watching you be in love with someone else. Someone, incidentally, who will never love you back. Not the way I do."
"You love me?"
"You stupid Nephilim," Magnus said patiently. "Why else am I here? Why else would I have spent the past few weeks patching up all your moronic friends every time they got hurt, and getting you out of every ridiculous situation you found yourself in? Not to mention helping you win a battle against Valentine, and all completely free of charge."
"I hadn't looked at it that way," Alec admitted.
"Of course not. You never look at it in any way." Magnus's cat eyes shone with anger. "I'm 700 years old, Alexander. I know when something isn't going to work. You won't even admit I exist to your parents." Alec stared at him. "You're 700 years old?"
"Well," Magnus amended, 800. "But I don't look it. Anyway, you're missing the point. The point is..."
But Alec never found out what the point was, because at that moment a dozen more Iblis demons flooded into the square. He felt his jaw drop.
"Damn it."
Magnus followed his gaze. The demons were already fanning out into a half circle around them, their yellow eyes glowing.
"Way to change the subject, Lightwood."
"Tell you what." Alec reached for a second seraph blade. "We live through this, and I promise I'll introduce you to my whole family." Magnus raised his hands, his fingers shining with individual azure flames. They lit his grin with a fiery blue glow.
"It's a deal."
Chapter 11. All the Host of Hell.
"Valentine," Jace breathed.
His face was white as he stared down at the city. Through the layers of smoke, Clary thought she could almost glimpse the narrow warren of city streets, choked with running figures, tiny black ants darting desperately to and fro. But she looked again and there was nothing. Nothing but the thick clouds of black vapor and the stench of flame and smoke.
"You think Valentine did this?"
The smoke was bitter in Clary's throat.
"It looks like a fire. Maybe it started on its own."
"The north gate is open." Jace pointed toward something Clary could barely make out, given the distance and the distorting smoke. "It's never left open. And the demon towers have lost their light. The wards must be down." He drew a seraph blade from his belt, clutching it so tightly his knuckles turned the color of ivory. "I have to get over there." A knot of dread tightened Clary's throat.
"Simon."
"They'll have evacuated him from the guard. Don't worry, Clary. He's probably better off than most down there. The demons aren't likely to bother him. They tend to leave downworlders alone."
"I'm sorry," Clary whispered. "The Lightwoods. Alec, Isabel."
"Jahuel," Jace said, and the angel blade flared up bright as daylight in his bandaged left hand. "Clary, I want you to stay here. I'll come back for you."
The anger that had been in his eyes since they'd left the manor had evaporated. He was all soldier now. She shook her head.
No, I want to go with you.
Clary. He broke off, stiffening all over. A moment later, Clary heard it too. A heavy, rhythmic pounding, and laid over that, a sound like the crackling of an enormous bonfire. It took Clary several long moments to deconstruct the sound in her mind, to break it down as one might break down a piece of music into its component notes.
It's...
werewolves. Jace was staring past her. Following his gaze, she saw them, streaming over the nearest hill like a spreading shadow, illuminated here and there with fierce, bright eyes. A pack of wolves. More than a pack. There must have been hundreds of them, even 1,000. Their barking and baying had been the sound she thought was a fire, and it rose up into the night, brittle and harsh. Clary's stomach turned over. She knew werewolves. She had fought beside werewolves. But these were not Luke's wolves, not wolves who'd been instructed to look after her and not to harm her. She thought of the terrible killing power of Luke's pack when it was unleashed, and suddenly she was afraid. Beside her, Jace swore once fiercely. There was no time to reach for another weapon. He pulled her tightly against him, his free arm wrapped around her, and with his other hand he raised Jahuel high over their heads. The light of the blade was blinding. Clary gritted her teeth. And the wolves were on them. It was like a wave crashing, a sudden blast of deafening noise, and a rush of air as the first wolves in the pack broke forward and leaped. There were burning eyes and gaping jaws. Jace dug his fingers into Clary's side, and the wolves sailed by on either side of them, clearing the space where they stood by a good 2 feet. Clary whipped her head around in disbelief as 2 wolves, one sleek and brindled, the other huge and steely gray, hit the ground softly behind them, paused, and kept running, without even a backward glance. There were wolves all around them, and yet not a single wolf touched them. They raced past, a flood of shadows, their coats reflecting moonlight in flashes of silver so that they almost seemed to be a single, moving river of shapes thundering toward Jason Clary, and then parting around them like water around a stone. The 2 shadow hunters might as well have been statues for all the attention the lycanthropes paid them as they hurtled by, their jaws gaping, their eyes fixed on the road ahead of them. And then they were gone. Jace turned to watch the last of the wolves pass by and race to catch up with its companions. There was silence again now, only the very faint sounds of the city in the distance. Jace let go of Clary, lowering Jahuel as he did so.
"Are you all right?"
"What happened?" she whispered. "Those werewolves, they just went right by us."
"They're going to the city. To Alicante."
He took a second seraph blade from his belt and held it out to her.
"You'll need this."
"You're not leaving me here, then?"
"No point. It's not safe anywhere."
"But..."
He hesitated. "You'll be careful?"
"I'll be careful," Clary said.
"What do we do now?"
Jace looked down at Alicante, burning below them.
"Now, we run."
It was never easy to keep up with Jace, and now, when he was running nearly flat out, it was almost impossible. Clary sensed that he was, in fact, restraining himself, cutting back his speed to let her catch up, and that it cost him something to do it. The road flattened out at the base of the hill and curved through a stand of high, thickly branched trees, creating the illusion of a tunnel. When Clary came out the other side, she found herself standing before the north gate. Through the arch, Clary could see a confusion of smoke and leaping flames. Jace stood in the gateway waiting for her. He was holding Jahuel in one hand, and another seraph blade in the other, but even their combined light was lost against the greater brightness of the burning city behind him. "The guards," she panted, racing up to him. "Why aren't they here?"
"At least one of them is over in that stand of trees."
Jace jerked his chin in the direction they'd come from.
"In pieces. No, don't look."
He glanced down.
"You're holding your seraph blade wrong. Hold it like this."
He showed her.
"And you need to name it. Cassiel would be a good one."
"Cassiel," Clary repeated, and the light of the blade flared up. Jace looked at her soberly.
"I wish I'd had time to train you for this.
Of course, by all rights, no one with as little training as you should be able to use a Seraph Blade at all. It surprised me before, but now that we know what Valentine did...
Clary very much did not want to talk about what Valentine had done.
Or maybe you were just worried that if you did train me properly, I'd turn out to be better than you, she said.
The ghost of a smile touched the corner of his mouth.
Whatever happens, Clary, he said, looking at her through Jahoel's light, stay with me. You understand?
He held her gaze, his eyes demanding a promise from her. For some reason, the memory of kissing him in the grass at the Wayland Manor rose up in her mind. It seemed like a million years ago, like something that had happened to someone else. I'll stay with you.
Good. He looked away, releasing her. Let's go.
They moved slowly through the gate, side by side. As they entered the city, she became aware of the noise of battle as if for the first time. A wall of sound made up of human screams and non-human howls, the sounds of smashing glass and the crackle of fire. It made the blood sing in her ears. The courtyard just past the gate was empty. There were huddled shapes scattered here and there on the cobblestones. Clary tried not to look at them too hard. She wondered how it was that you could tell someone was dead even from a distance, without looking too closely. Dead bodies didn't resemble unconscious ones. It was as if you could sense that something had fled from them, that some essential spark was now missing. Jace hurried them across the courtyard. Clary could tell he didn't like the open, unprotected space much, and down one of the streets that led off it. There was more wreckage here. Shop windows had been smashed and their contents looted and strewn around the street. There was a smell in the air, too. A rancid, thick, garbage smell. Clary knew that smell. It meant demons. This way, Jace hissed. They ducked down another narrower street. A fire was burning in an upper floor of one of the houses lining the road, though neither of the buildings on either side of it seemed to have been touched. Clary was oddly reminded of photos she'd seen of the Blitz in London, where destruction had rained down haphazardly from the sky. Looking up, she saw that the fortress above the city was wreathed in a funnel of black smoke.
The guard!
I told you, they'll have evacuated. Jace broke off as they came out from the narrow street into a larger thoroughfare. There were bodies in the road here, several of them. Some were small bodies. Children. Jace ran forward, Clary following more hesitantly. There were three, she saw as they got closer. None of them, she thought with guilty relief, old enough to be Max. Beside them was the corpse of an older man, his arms still thrown wide as if he'd been protecting the children with his own body. Jace's expression was hard.
Clary, turn around. Slowly.
Clary turned. Just behind her was a broken shop window. There had been cakes in the display at some point, a tower of them covered in bright icing. They were scattered on the ground now among the smashed glass, and there was blood on the cobblestones, too, mixing with the icing in long pinkish streaks. But that wasn't what had put the note of warning into Jace's voice. Something was crawling out of the window. Something formless and huge and slimy. Something equipped with a double row of teeth running the length of its oblong body, which was smeared with icing and dusted with broken glass like a layer of glittering sugar. The demon flopped down out of the window onto the cobblestones and began to slither toward them. Something about its oozing, boneless motion made bile rise up in the back of Clary's throat. She backed up, almost knocking into Jace.
It's a behemoth demon, he said, staring at the slithering thing in front of them. They eat everything.
Do they eat?
People? Yes, Jace said. Get behind me.
She took a few steps back to stand behind him, her eyes on the behemoth. There was something about it that repulsed her even more than the demons she'd encountered before. It looked like a blind slug with teeth, and the way it oozed. But at least it didn't move fast. Jace shouldn't have much trouble killing it. As if spurred on by her thought, Jace started forward, slashing down with his blazing Seraph Blade. It sank into the behemoth's back with a sound like overripe fruit being stepped on. The demon seemed to spasm, then shudder and reform, suddenly several feet away from where it had been before. Jace drew Jahoel back.
I was afraid of that, he muttered. It's only semi-corporeal. Hard to kill.
Then don't. Clary tugged at his sleeve. At least it doesn't move fast. Let's get out of here.
Jace let her pull him back reluctantly. They turned to run in the direction they'd come from. And the demon was there again, in front of them, blocking the street. It seemed to have grown bigger, and a low noise was coming from it, a sort of angry, insectile chittering.
I don't think it wants us to leave, Jace said.
Jace.
But he was already running at the thing, sweeping Jahoel down in a long arc meant to decapitate, but the thing just shuddered again and reformed, this time behind him. It reared up, showing a ridged underside like a cockroach's. Jace whirled and brought Jahoel down, slicing into the creature's midsection. Green fluid, thick as mucus, spurted over the blade. Jace stepped back, his face twisting in disgust. The behemoth was still making the same chittering noise. More fluid was spurting from it, but it didn't seem hurt. It was moving forward, purposefully.
Jace, Clary called, your blade!
He looked down. The behemoth demon's mucus had coated Jahuel's blade, dulling its flame. As he stared, the seraph blade spluttered and went out like a fire doused by sand. He dropped the weapon with a curse before any of the demon's slime could touch him. The behemoth reared back again, ready to strike. Jace ducked back, and then Clary was there, darting between him and the demon, her seraph blade swinging. She jabbed the creature just below its row of teeth, the blade sinking into its mass with a wet, ugly sound. She jerked back, gasping, as the demon went into another spasm. It seemed to take the creature a certain amount of energy to reform each time it was wounded. If they could just wound it enough times. Something moved at the edge of Clary's vision. A flicker of gray and brown moving fast. They weren't alone in the street. Jace turned, his eyes widening.
Clary, he shouted. Behind you!
Clary whirled, Cassio blazing in her grip, just as the wolf launched itself at her, its lips drawn back in a fierce snarl, its jaws gaping wide. Jace shouted something. Clary didn't know what, but she saw the wild look in his eyes, even as she threw herself sideways out of the path of the wolf. It sailed by her, claws outstretched, body arced, and struck its target, the behemoth, knocking it flat to the ground before tearing at it with bared teeth. The demon screamed, or as close as it could come to screaming, a high-pitched whining sound, like air being let out of a balloon. The wolf was on top of it, pinning it, its muzzle buried deep in the demon's slimy hide. The behemoth shuddered and thrashed in a desperate effort to reform and heal its injuries, but the wolf wasn't giving it a chance. Its claws sunk deeply into demon flesh. The wolf tore chunks of jelly-like flesh out of the behemoth's body with its teeth, ignoring the spurting green fluid that fountained around it. The behemoth began a last, desperate series of convulsive spasms, its serrated jaws clacking together as it thrashed. And then it was gone, only a viscous puddle of green fluid steaming on the cobblestones where it had been. The wolf made a noise, a sort of satisfied grunt, and turned to regard Jason Clary with eyes turned silver by the moonlight. Jace pulled another blade from his belt and held it high, drawing a fiery line on the air between themselves and the werewolf. The wolf snarled, the hair rising stiffly along its spine. Clary caught at his arm.
No, don't.
It's a werewolf, Clary.
It killed the demon for us. It's on our side.
She broke away from Jace before he could hold her back, approaching the wolf slowly, her hands out, palms flat. She spoke in a low, calm voice.
I'm sorry. We're sorry. We know you don't want to hurt us.
She paused, hands still outstretched, as the wolf regarded her with blank eyes.
Who are you? She asked.
She looked back over her shoulder at Jace and frowned.
Can you put that thing away?
Jace looked as if he were about to tell her in no uncertain terms that you didn't just put away a seraph blade that was blazing in the presence of danger. But before he could say anything, the wolf gave another low growl and began to rise. Its legs elongated, its spine straightening, its jaws retracting. In a few seconds, a girl stood in front of them. A girl wearing a stained white shift dress, her curling hair tied back in multiple braids, a scar banding her throat.
Who are you? The girl mimicked in disgust.
I can't believe you didn't recognize me. It's not like all wolves look exactly alike. Humans.
Clary let out a breath of relief. Maya!
It's me, saving your butts as usual. She grinned. She was spattered with blood and ichor. It hadn't been that visible against her wolf's coat, but the black and red streak stood out startlingly against her brown skin. She put her hand against her stomach. And gross, by the way. I can't believe I munched all that demon. I hope I'm not allergic.
But what are you doing here? Clary demanded. I mean, not that we're not glad to see you, but...
Don't you know? Maya looked from Jace to Clary in puzzlement. Luke brought us here.
Luke? Clary stared. Luke is here?
Maya nodded. He got in touch with his pack and a bunch of others, everyone he could think of, and told us all we had to come to Idris. We flew to the border and traveled from there. Some of the other packs, they portaled into the forest and met us there. Luke said the Nephilim were going to need our help. Her voice trailed off. Did you not know about this?
No, said Jace. And I doubt the Clave did either. They're not big on taking help from downworlders.
Maya straightened up, her eyes sparking with anger. If it hadn't been for us, you all would have been slaughtered. There was no one protecting the city when we got here.
Don't, Clary said, shooting an angry look at Jace. I'm really, really grateful to you for saving us, Maya. And Jace is too, even though he's so stubborn that he'd rather jam a Seraph blade through his eyeball than say so. And don't say you hope he does, she added hastily, seeing the look on the other girl's face, because that's not really helpful. Right now, we need to get to the Lightwoods' house, and then I have to find Luke.
The Lightwoods? I think they're in the Accords Hall. That's where we've been bringing everyone.
I saw Alec there, at least, Maya said. And that warlock, too. The one with the spiky hair? Magnus?
If Alec is there, the others must be, too.
The look of relief on Jace's face made Clary want to put her hand on his shoulder. She didn't.
Clever to bring everyone to the hall. It's warded.
He slid the glowing Seraph blade into his belt.
Come on, let's go.
Clary recognized the inside of the Hall of Accords the moment she entered it. It was the place she had dreamed about, where she had been dancing with Simon and then Jace. This was where I was trying to send myself when I went through the portal, she thought, looking around at the pale white walls and the high ceiling with its enormous glass skylight, through which she could see the night sky. The room, though very large, seemed somehow smaller and dingier than it had in her dream. The mermaid fountain was still there in the center of the room, spurting water, but it looked tarnished, and the steps that led up to it were crowded with people, many sporting bandages. The space was full of shadow hunters, people hurrying here and there, sometimes stopping to peer into the faces of other passers-by, as if hoping to find a friend or a relative. The floor was filthy with dirt, tracked with smeared mud and blood. What struck Clary more than anything else was the silence. If this had been the aftermath of some disaster in the mundane world, there would have been people shouting, screaming, calling out to one another. But the room was almost soundless. People sat quietly, some with their heads in their hands, some staring into space. Children huddled close to their parents, but none of them were crying. She noticed something else, too, as she made her way into the room, Jace and Maya on either side of her. There was a group of scruffy-looking people standing by the fountain in a ragged circle. They stood somehow apart from the rest of the crowd, and when Maya caught sight of them and smiled, Clary realized why.
My pack! Maya exclaimed.
She darted toward them, pausing only to glance back over her shoulder at Clary as she went.
I'm sure Luke's around here somewhere, she called, and vanished into the group which closed around her.
Clary wondered for a moment what would happen if she followed the werewolf girl into the circle. Would they welcome her as Luke's friend, or just be suspicious of her as another shadow hunter?
Don't, Jace said, as if reading her mind. It's not a good...
But Clary never found out what it wasn't, because there was a cry of, Jace! And Alec appeared, breathless from pushing his way through the crowd to get to them. His dark hair was a mess,
and there was blood on his clothes, but his eyes were bright with a mixture of relief and anger. He grabbed Jace by the front of his jacket.
"What happened to you?"
Jace looked affronted.
"What happened to me?"
Alec shook him, not lightly.
"You said you were going for a walk. What kind of walk takes 6 hours?
"A long one?" Jace suggested.
"I could kill you," Alec said, releasing his grip on Jace's clothes. "I'm seriously thinking about it."
"That would kind of defeat the purpose, though, wouldn't it?"
said Jace. He glanced around.
"Where is everyone?"
Isabel and Max are back at the Penhollows with Sebastian," said Alec. "Mom and Dad are on their way there to get them, and Aline's here with her parents, but she's not talking much. She had a pretty bad time with a Rezcor demon down by one of the canals, but Izzy saved her."
"And Simon?" Clary said anxiously. "Have you seen Simon? He should have come down with the others from the guard."
Alec shook his head. "No, I haven't. But I haven't seen the Inquisitor either, or the Consul. He'd probably be with one of them. Maybe they stopped somewhere else, or..." He broke off as a murmur swept the room. Clary saw the group of lycanthropes look up, alert as a group of hunting dogs scenting game. She turned and saw Luke, tired and bloodstained, coming through the double doors of the hall. She ran toward him, forgetting how upset she'd been when he'd left, and forgetting how angry he'd been with her for bringing them here, forgetting everything but how glad she was to see him. He looked surprised for a moment as she barreled toward him, then he smiled and put his arms out and picked her up as he hugged her, the way he'd done when she'd been very small. He smelled like blood and flannel and smoke, and for a moment she closed her eyes, thinking of the way Alec had grabbed onto Jace the moment he'd seen him in the hall, because that was what you did with family when you'd been worried about them. You grabbed them and held on to them and told them how much they'd pissed you off, and it was okay, because no matter how angry you got, they still belonged to you. And what she had said to Valentine was true. Luke was her family. He set her back down on her feet, wincing a little as he did so.
"Careful," he said. "A croucher demon got me in the shoulder by the Merryweather Bridge."
He put his hands on her shoulders, studying her face.
"But you're all right, aren't you?"
"Well, this is a touching scene," said a cold voice. "Isn't it?"
Clary turned, Luke's hand still on her shoulder. Behind her stood a tall man in a blue cloak that swirled around his feet as he moved toward them. His face under the hood of his cloak was the face of a carved statue, high cheekboned with eagle-sharp features and heavy-lidded eyes.
"Lucian," he said, without looking at Clary. "I might have expected you'd be the one behind this invasion."
"Invasion?" Luke echoed,
and suddenly there was his pack of lycanthropes standing behind him. They had moved into place so quickly and silently, it was as if they'd appeared from out of nowhere.
"We're not the ones who invaded your city, Consul. That was Valentine. We're just trying to help."
"The Clave doesn't need help," the Consul snapped.
"Not from the likes of you. You're breaking the law just by entering the Glass City, wards or no wards. You must know that."
"I think it's fairly clear that the Clave does need help. If we hadn't come when we did, many more of you would now be dead."
Luke glanced around the room. Several groups of shadow hunters had moved toward them, drawn to see what was going on. Some of them met Luke's gaze head on, others dropped their eyes as if ashamed. But none of them, Clary thought with a sudden surge of surprise, looked angry.
"I did it to prove a point, Malachi."
Malachi's voice was cold.
"And what point might that be?"
"That you need us," Luke said.
"To defeat Valentine, you need our help. Not just the help of lycanthropes, but of all downworlders."
"What can downworlders do against Valentine?" Malachi asked scornfully.
"Lucian, you know better than that. You were one of us once. We have always stood alone against all perils and guarded the world from evil. We will meet Valentine's power now with a power of our own. The downworlders would do well to stay out of our way. We are Nephilim. We fight our own battles."
"That's not precisely true, is it?" said a velvety voice.
It was Magnus Bane, wearing a long and glittering coat, multiple hoops in his ears, and a roguish expression. Clary had no idea where he'd come from.
"You lot have used the help of warlocks on more than one occasion in the past, and paid handsomely for it, too."
Malachi scowled.
"I don't remember the Clave inviting you into the Glass City, Magnus Bane."
"They didn't," Magnus said. "Your wards are down?"
"Really?"
The consul's voice dripped sarcasm.
"I hadn't noticed."
Magnus looked concerned.
"That's terrible. Someone should have told you."
He glanced at Luke.
"Tell him the wards are down."
Luke looked exasperated.
"Malachi, for God's sake, the downworlders are strong. We have numbers. I told you we can help."
The consul's voice rose.
"And I told you, we don't need or want your help."
"Magnus." Clary slipped silently to his side and whispered. A small crowd had gathered, watching Luke and the consul fight. She was fairly sure no one was paying attention to her. "Come talk to me, while they're all too busy squabbling to notice." Magnus gave her a quick, questioning look, nodded, and drew her away, cutting through the crowd like a can opener. None of the assembled shadow hunters or werewolves seemed to want to stand in the way of a 6-foot-tall warlock with cat eyes and a manic grin. He hustled her into a quieter corner.
"What is it?"
"I got the book." Clary drew it from the pocket of her bedraggled coat, leaving smeared fingerprints on the ivory cover. "I went to Valentine's Manor. It was in the library, like you said, and..." She broke off, thinking of the imprisoned angel. "Never mind." She offered him the Book of the White. "Here, take it." Magnus plucked the book from her grasp with a long-fingered hand. He flipped through the pages, his eyes widening.
"This is even better than I'd heard it was," he announced gleefully. "I can't wait to get started on these spells."
"Magnus." Clary's sharp voice brought him back down to earth. "My mom first. You promised."
"And I abide by my promises."
The warlock nodded gravely, but there was something in his eyes, something Clary didn't quite trust. "There's something else, too," she added, thinking of Simon. "Before you go..."
"Clary."
A voice spoke breathless at her shoulder. She turned in surprise to see Sebastian standing beside her. He was wearing gear, and it looked right on him somehow, she thought, as if he were born to wear it. Where everyone else looked bloodstained and disheveled, he was unmarked, except for a double line of scratches that ran the length of his left cheek, as if something had clawed at him with a taloned hand.
"I was worried about you. I went by Amatis's house on the way here, but you weren't there, and she said she hadn't seen you."
"Well, I'm fine." Clary glanced from Sebastian to Magnus, who was holding the Book of the White against his chest. Sebastian's angular eyebrows were raised.
"Are you? Your face."
She reached up to touch his injuries. The scratches were still oozing a trace amount of blood. Sebastian shrugged, brushing her hand away gently.
"A she-demon got me near the Penhollows. I'm fine, though."
"What's going on?"
"Nothing. I was just talking to Ragnar,
Clary said hastily, realizing with a sudden horror that Sebastian had no idea who Magnus actually was.
"Ma Ragnar?"
Sebastian arched his eyebrows.
"Okay, then."
He glanced curiously at the Book of the White. Clary wished Magnus would put it away. The way he was holding it, its gilded lettering was clearly visible.
"What's that?"
Magnus studied him for a moment, his cat eyes considering.
"A spell book," he said finally. "Nothing that would be of interest to a shadow hunter. Actually, my aunt collects spellbooks. Can I see?"
Sebastian held his hand out, but before Magnus could refuse, Clary heard someone call her name, and Jace and Alec descended on them, clearly none too pleased to see Sebastian.
"I thought I told you to stay with Max and Isabel," Alec snapped at him. "Did you leave them alone?"